It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. From Windows Central, Daniel Rubino's here. Lisa Schmeiser from IT Pro Today. And Lindsay Turrentine from, oh boy, she's got a big title, from CBS Viacom. She's big shot. We're going to talk about a lot of things, including the Build conference. Microsoft, I think, did some really interesting things at Build. And a review, not only of the Surface Buds, but Daniel's going to talk about the new Minecraft Dungeons game. Oh, boy! We'll also talk about people working from home, the Joe Rogan podcast moving to Spotify, and the poor grandma who had to remove pictures of her grandkids due to GDPR. It's all coming up next on Twit. This Week in Tech comes to you from the Twit LastPass studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 772, recorded Sunday, May 24th, 2020. 52 cents in a bag of pop chips. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Epson's EcoTank printers. These days, when many of us are working from home or helping our kids with homework, we need the right printer. The Epson EcoTank makes it easy. Add the Epson EcoTank printers to your online shopping list at Best Buy, Office Depot, Office Max, Staples, and at Epson.com/EcoTankLeo. And by IT Pro TV. Learn the ins and outs of IT careers and get the most up-to-date training with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use the code TWIT30 at checkout. And by LastPass. Prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass, trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit LastPass.com/TWIT to find out how they can help you. And by CashFly. Give your users the seamless online experience they want. Power your site or app with CashFly's CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news, kind of our weekly ritual where I can get my mind straight by hanging out with people who seem to be handling the quarantine much better than I am. Including, and it's amazing, Lindsay Turrentine, who is ensconced with how many men? Five men?
Let's see. There are four men and one teenage girl.
And you.
And me.
It's a big family.
Some of those men are teenagers also.
Yes. Boys. Boys to men. Lindsay's SVP. We went through this before the show, but I believe I have the title correct. Senior Vice President for Content Strategy at Viacom CBS. Is that the same as the former CBS Interactive?
Yeah, it's similar. It's larger now,
similar.
But it is similar. Yeah, and so I work on the CNET Media.
You're a big brand. Shot, is what you are.
You know, I'm just doing what I do.
Just doing what I do, man. Well, it's great to have you. Also with us. This is fun because these are all people I just really love getting together with. Lisa Schmeiser, who normally comes to the studio, can't do it these days, but she's here via Skype, which is nearly as good. Lisa is editor at IT Pro Today. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
She has, is that your old race car number 9 behind you there?
I believe it's a number for a baseball player. My husband's office right now, so the decor is entirely on him.
It's his retired number from when he played for the San Francisco Giants. That's so nice.
Or the Cubs.
Or the Cubs. Number 9 for the Cubs. That sounds vaguely familiar. Maybe Daniel Rubino knows. He is also here. No idea. Executive editor, Windows Central. Ask him about video game controllers. He can help you.
Yes.
But
It's one of those weird hobbies.
He's got every color in the rainbow. That's really,
that's like a quarter of them too. There's way more out in the other room.
It's amazing. So. It's great to have you. This is actually, you're here for a very special reason because this week Microsoft had its developer conference, Build conference, for the first time ever, entirely streaming. I saw some numbers, like 300,000 people watched the streams. It was a huge number.
Yep. Compared to 6,000 or 4,000 I normally attend in person. Yeah, so
I'd love to see this from now on from all the developer conferences. It's nice to not have to get in a lottery to figure out, you know, if you get to go, pay a lot of money to go. And this way you can see it all. I just really like it. And I have to say, I enjoyed the keynotes. We streamed the keynotes live on Tuesday. I never really quite know what Satya Nadella is talking about.
We joke around about that too. There's a lot of words. There's a lot of you feel good, but you don't really know what's being said and why it's important.
It's funny because I have huge respect for him.
Doing well.
Yeah, I mean, sure. He is clearly a great CEO who has pivoted Microsoft into a much more successful lane, and he's doing great. He's a caring guy. He's a deep guy. But I can't follow what he's saying. I did pick up though on a couple of things. This fusion, he mentioned fusion, and I thought, well, wait a minute, what's that? This is a new programming platform that brings together Win32 and PW.
Oh, Project Reunion.
I'm sorry, Reunion, not Fusion.
Yeah,
WPA apps, the Windows Store apps, and the Win32 apps. That seemed fairly important, or maybe that was just my imagination.
No, that was, and you know, if you're not a developer or you're, you know, like me, you just follow Microsoft, but you don't actually write stuff. This was probably one of the biggest and most interesting announcements. In a way, it's not even new. It's what's been happening for the last few years already that they've been talking about. They just kind of gave it a name and a formality this time. And you know, it's really, It is the next where this stuff is moving, right? So they have multiple development platforms for their apps. Win32, the stuff that goes back, you know, 20, 30 years. It's what makes Windows so powerful. But then, of course, you have Universal Windows apps and UWP, which was more modern. And they still encourage developers to go down that route. If you're doing something on HoloLens, Surface Hub, or any of their future devices, Windows 10X included, UWP is that platform. But what they're doing now is basically any APIs that are coming out will target both of these systems. And they're trying to get rid of this idea of, like, developers can only have to choose one platform to develop on. They can do whatever they feel comfortable with, whatever their goals are, whatever their strategy is, whatever their budget is as well. And that's why, you know, PWAs, progressive web apps, are becoming increasingly popular too. And we see a lot of that with Microsoft Edge and announcements around there. And so all they're trying to do is get away from this idea of, you know, a single system that people need to rely on. Because even though UWP made more sense on phones, or at least had more of an argument for it, the fact is the UI system, what's now part of WinUI 3.0, is very modern. It's very fresh looking. It's fast. It's dynamic. It allows scalable and resizable apps. There's a lot of positive stuff about UWP that does make it the future of app development for Microsoft and its platforms. But you can't just throw out Win32 as well due to all the legacy. So what the system allows devs to do now is take those old apps, those old Win32 apps, and bring in the stuff from UWP, the positive stuff, into it, including the UI. So you can actually make modern-looking, classic-running applications. And so, like I said, that's been happening for the last few years behind the scenes, but this is more, it's been kind of formalized and they're kind of laying it out with WinUI and a couple other new systems are coming out.
This is a big deal because, of course, Microsoft, unlike any other operating system, really depends on legacy. You've got many, many business users who are running old software. You'd like to bring them into the modern times, not just for the way it looks and feels, but for security reasons, reliability reasons. So if they can provide a platform that makes it easy for people who have Win32 programs to bring it up to modern times, that could be very important going forward for Microsoft. It's a way of handling this legacy problem that's always been kind of tying them down.
Yep.
Good. The other thing, and then we'll move on. The other thing I heard him mention that I thought was really interesting for years. It seems like Apple went through this, Microsoft's gone through it in several different ways. they've wanted to reimagine the document, that it's not just a collection of text or pictures smushed together in a single file that then gets rendered by an application, but instead it's something alive that can have components from a variety of places. It's kind of that object model desktop that Apple talked about and Microsoft talked about, and now they've got something called Fluid.
Are you the Fluid UI design?
I heard that giggle. It's the is that what I'm talking about? That's yes. So Windows IT Pro. Explain this to me, Lisa.
So the reason I'm laughing is when I was at InfoWorld, my colleague Galen Grumman came up with the term fluid computing to describe the experience of beginning a computing task on one device and then continuing it via the cloud through other devices. And the example he gave was in starting a story on his iPad and then finishing it on his laptop.
That's sensible.
And I'm not sure the phrase fluid computing ever really gained traction outside our office. But the notion that we've uncoupled the task flow and the results of that task flow from a device is not exactly new. And when I'm looking at what Microsoft's doing here, it's a really logical continuation of what they've been pushing with how they want to affect business productivity and end user experiences for the past few years. I've sat in enough sessions at Ignite or listened to enough streaming press events or other dev events where they've talked about breaking out of application silos. I don't know if they necessarily use that phrasing, but that's the end result, is the idea that instead of switching between applications and having to switch modes of working, they're envisioning pushing people into just one workspace and then thinking about your work in terms of how am I manipulating this data? Where is it coming from? What do I want to do with it in the end?
Yeah, and, I mean, we've been tied
again, it's fluid computing. Galen nailed it down in like 2011, right. 2012.
we've been kind of tied to this notion that a document is like a physical, it's kind of a skeuomorphic way of looking at things, a piece of paper that you type on, and that's a document, and when we just made a digital version. So there, it's a little confusing.
Personal computing when they first introduced it.
Yeah, look. I think you go back.
Arguably, people are trying to find a new metaphor now.
Exactly. You go back to Doug Engelbart's, demo. The whole idea was, well, a document is a kind of a holder for a variety of things. So this new, I guess it's a new kind of office document that uses fluid components to, like, this is The Verge calls it, like Lego blocks that to me, when we talked about this, it sounded a little bit like Google's Wave, that it was very short-lived. Where a document
is an opportunity to use the Minecraft metaphor instead of the Lego metaphor.
Yeah, maybe they should have called it Minecraft. maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but we've tried to do this before, and it seems like a great idea. Remember the Works programs where you'd have one document, you could put a graph in it, a database in it. This is even that on steroids. I mean, it could be a lot of different kinds of components. Well, this will give you some idea. This is the animated GIF that Microsoft put out, which is actually giving me a headache. But so am I characterizing this properly, Daniel, or is that not what is? Because then there's also the fluid UI, which seems to be web design.
Right. Yeah. So there is this idea of the fluid computing concept is also, I think, part of this larger goal that they have, which is ambient computing. This idea that you just have screens, operating systems are streamed to your device. Everything's a lot more dynamic and, to use that word, fluid, right? This idea that instead of you booting up a PC and have to load an application and then bring down the document, everything is kind of brought to you and you're less restricted to the device itself. And this idea of computing is going to be really interesting how it's changing. Desktop computing is always going to be a thing, just like laptops, but how those evolve over the next 5, 10, 15 years, especially with 5G and how operating systems are changing. And you're going to see that with Windows 10X, of course, which is more going down that route of what a future operating system looks like. And I think that, what's been described here is that other piece of it, the actual productivity end of how modern operating systems should behave and are less restricted to the actual physical hardware that we use day to day.
I love this idea. That's exactly right. But it's historically been difficult to do. By the way, I just noticed you're wearing the Surface earbuds. Do you like those?
Yes, I do.
I thought it was just a fancy piece of jewelry. I didn't.
Nope. They're really nice. I mean, you know, my review went up for them this week. I spent a good 2 weeks with them and spent really a lot of detail into them. And the bottom line, I gave them like a 3 out of 5 for a rating. So I personally really like them a lot and I use them all
the time.
They're
so big. Don't you think they're kind of large?
So they're large for a couple of reasons. The battery life, you know, they get 8 hours per charge, which they're meant to be, you put them in and leave them in all day. And you can kind of think of these as being sort of like lifestyle earphones. And this is a very niche and unique aspect to these. And I got to give Microsoft credit. At least it's a way to differentiate themselves from every other earbud. But if you're looking for little earbuds you put in for an hour or two just to listen to your music and you want to tune out the world, these are not for you. These are meant to, you can kind of think of it in the future where you just carry around one earpiece maybe even. But you can hear ambient noise around you. Someone comes up to you and talks to you. You don't have to be like, wait, what? Because you're going to be able to hear everything. At the same time, you can hear from your devices. You can stream media. You can take that conference call.
Are you using their microphone right now or are you using a separate microphone?
No.
Okay.
I could, but yeah, I have a pretty
good you have a much better sounding mic.
But the mics are pretty good on them. But so the size is for a couple of reasons. So the battery life is very good. Two, they're gesture supported. So on one side, you do volume up, volume down by swiping down. And on the other side, you go forward or back to skip tracks. And there's also the double tap. So I think they had to have a large enough surface area because you're not looking at yourself when you're doing it. So you need a sort of a target.
I think they actually look good now that I'm kind of getting used to it. They look better than those drippy AirPods.
Right. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that, you know, because AirPods are now accepted.
Everybody has them. We don't even notice it anymore. I'm watching CNN, and that's all anybody's wearing now.
That's all you see, right? And so they're still weird looking.
We just got used to it.
Yeah, it's no different than bell bottoms, and it is a fashion thing, right? Bell bottoms were huge years ago, right? In the 70s, you could go rock bell bottoms today. People would just look at you weird. You know, like, oh, that's different. But if everybody started wearing them again, it would just be that, right?
Right.
So one thing I do like about them is when I'm looking at you, and the profile is actually very slim. You don't really see them.
It's only when you turn your head.
It's only when you turn your head. Yeah. So the audio quality is very good. My issue with them is I think they're a little expensive at $200.
That's the price point now. I mean, AirPod Pros are $250. Anything from Beats is going to be that much.
Yeah, but if you look at like some like Galaxy Buds or the Pixel Buds or
those
even
are half
just regular,
as much. Yeah,
those are half. And like even, you know, I would compare these to regular AirPods because they don't have noise cancellation on them, either passive or inactive. So there's none of that here. The case, you know, which is right here, is actually really nice, but it doesn't have wireless charging, which I think a lot of people expect.
Oh,
you know,
it's not a battery case. You have to plug it in.
It's a battery case, but it uses a Type-C plug, right?
Oh, well, that's all right. That's the original AirPods. Okay, that's fine. As long as you can charge the buds in the case.
You can. And so you get 24 hours. You get 8 hours of the initial charge and two more charges with this.
So they're probably the longest lasting of anything out there right now.
And this is the other big thing. They're so comfortable. They really nailed the ergonomics of how this works.
So you can wear them all day.
I put these things in and you basically forget they're there. They don't fall out. They lock into place into that ear. And I can wear them for 8 hours and wouldn't even think about it. And that's really different from earbuds that go into the ear canal, which, you know, some people will enjoy. But I challenge anyone to wear those for 2 or 3 hours and see how their ears feel because it's going to be painful. Where these were meant to be, you get up, you put them on, go to the office, you work all day and you just wear them. And I think that's a neat market. It's not a mass market. Like, I think most people would probably be okay with Galaxy Buds or Pixel Buds or whatever. But for certain people who work in a professional environment who want all day earphones, I think these are kind of awesome. I just wish the price was a little bit lower to be more competitive.
That was a little sidelight because I am I am ADD, and I noticed you were wearing them, and I'm sorry.
We were talking about
Build. Let me ask Lindsay, because I don't know how much attention you paid to the Build conference, but you've been covering Microsoft for almost as long as somebody like me has. This is a very different company from the company of even 10 years ago.
That's true. What's not true is that I haven't actually been covering it very closely for a very long time. But what I will tell you is that
this ain't Bill Gates Microsoft.
It is not.
Or is it even Steve Ballmer's Microsoft?
I am consistently impressed with the way Satya is pushing us toward thinking about interconnected companies.
Yeah.
And the way in which we think about how technology should work with technology from competitors.
Right.
He seems to have completely moved on from this very competitive world that we were in when I started in technology journalism, where everything was a war.
Yeah.
And he just kind of ignores that and moves on and says, let's solve these problems. And that's what I really like and enjoy about watching this kind of from the sidelines. The other interesting thing that I'll say about Microsoft overall is that there's this sort of newfound love for Microsoft, and maybe, I don't know, maybe it came from the young gamers who fell in love with Minecraft, but I live with a lot of teenagers, and Microsoft is at all a dirty word.
Yeah. Do you have an Xbox at home?
We have a PlayStation, but really almost all of the entertainment happens on hand-built computers.
Oh, interesting.
That kids have built themselves.
Interesting.
Yep. Yeah. And they run Windows. And they're PC gamers, and they're young. It's a young, diverse set of PC gamers, and it's just not a dirty word anymore.
You nailed it, because, I mean, Bill Gates, with nothing else, and young people don't know about the old Bill Gates. They think he's that nice guy who's saving us from COVID-19.
Or giving it to us,
depending on their political persuasion.
Right.
Maybe he wants to microchip us. I don't know. I can't follow any of this conspiracy crap. But the Bill Gates of when he was CEO of Microsoft was a bloodthirsty shark who was feared and loathed by everybody else in the industry. This is a very different, you nailed it, Lindsay. This is a very different Microsoft. It's even different from Steve Ballmer, who said Linux open source is a cancer. And now all of a sudden, Microsoft's shipping, that's one of the things they announced this week, a Linux kernel in Windows Home as well as Windows Pro. The Linux subsystem or Windows subsystem for Linux is basically Linux on Windows. They've got a terminal program. The Minecraft is a perfect example. Compare the Minecraft acquisition and the value it added to Microsoft to the Nokia acquisition under Steve Ballmer and the value it subtracted from Microsoft. It's night and day. And they, you know, when they bought GitHub, I think the open source community was angered and disappointed and terrified. And I think they've completely mollified the open source community. They've embraced open source. Linux is the number one operating system running on Azure now. It comes with Windows now. It's such a different world. It's nothing like the old Microsoft. Were you impressed, Daniel, with the amount of open source embracing going on at Build?
Yeah, although, you know, it's not surprising. They have been talking about it for years now and just slowly rolling out things. You know, I know a lot of people are like, are they going to open source Windows itself? But
no,
I don't think that will happen.
Never.
But
no.
All these other technologies, developer tools, and, you know, they are returning to their roots in a lot of ways as a computing company. And that's what they focus on now. And I think under Ballmer, they tried to become a consumer company and compete with Apple. And we know how that ended up. And listen, I know, you know, obviously a Windows Phone user, I love Zune, but those were definitely failed strategies. And that's not what Microsoft is. And so back, you know, under Nadella, they're just returning to this idea of just generalized computing. Everything they're building is for developers and software engineers, and they're building out the systems for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And I think that's a nice change. And I think that's why people are really enjoying sort of this new renaissance at Microsoft. And yeah, no one really likes this idea of like, oh, we're going to, you know, crush everybody and
destroy
everyone.
It's a cuddly company. instead of embrace, what was it? Embrace and engulf and
extinguish.
Devour. Yeah, embrace and extinguish. It's like embrace and hug. It's a whole different. It's a whole different Microsoft. It's very interesting. Nadella had. Do you think that was his house or was that a set that he was on? This whole thing was streamed. Had a very
could be either. He has a nice house.
Yeah, well, obviously he's got a nice house. He had behind him, though. You can tell already. I'm fascinated by what's behind people. He had behind him. What was the letters? G, V, W, C, 2 C, W. I can't remember the exact letters. And we were looking at that, going, "There's a message." There, before the end of the stream, we did a live stream of his talk. Somebody tweeted, "Oh, that's the word devs, D-E-V-S, in base 64 encoded." It was an Easter egg, a secret Easter egg embracing devs that only a geeky dev would ever get. I thought it was great. Scott Hanselman followed and did, it was a work from home keynote where he showed off all his stuff, his hue lights and the glow and the purple, and he was having great fun and he was calling people and showing off stuff, and it went 10 times better than the average on stage demo, much less stilted. I haven't seen the rest of the stuff, but it seemed like they really did a good job in making Build engaging and entertaining and smart. At the same time,
it was the right balance between they had a lot of nerdy humor, which was nice, but they had a lot of good content.
Right.
And they had a lot of likable people who were just
Scott's great.
And that's tough to do. Yeah. Scott's, really fantastic. But they also had just a lot of good hosts. And that's a tough thing to pull off. They had to approach this differently. Instead of getting up on stage, I'm going to do my PowerPoint kind of thing.
Right.
It was more like a TV production where you had to have scripts and this idea of segues. And, they did a lot of funny things, too. But it was always just enough. It never got corny or cheesy. And I think that's why it kept people entertained. And I think that's tough to do. And I'm not sure that, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if Google and Apple and the rest of these companies can find that right balance. Because ultimately it comes down to like talent. Like Scott Hanselman is not just a great developer, he's able to be on camera and, do all that. And that's hard, right? You can't force that.
We were Googling RGV to CW. Through the whole thing and nothing came up, but now there's RGV2CW.com. Somebody registered the domain name. Let me see if it'll come up. Wow. Somebody registered the domain name. No, it's not coming up. And made a site before the keynote was over. I like that kind of geeky stuff. It'll be interesting. Google canceled their Google I/O completely. They're going to do it later, but Apple's developers conference is coming up next month. And I think the gauntlet's been thrown down. I think Microsoft's shown Apple the way to do it. I wonder if Apple will pick it up. They're historically so buttoned down and careful that
it's going to be like a pay-per-view event. It'll be $70 for everybody to watch it. Yeah. It's going to be behind a paywall. You can only watch on Apple TV. I can just see it now.
Wouldn't it be cool, Lindsay? I wonder if you see this. Do we need in-person conferences? Wouldn't it be cool if a lot of these conferences went online?
Oh my gosh. We have been spending so much time thinking about this. And there are so many opportunities to talk about this kind of concept. What's so interesting about doing things only digitally is that it opens up avenues that you can't do with any sort of hybrid model. So think about just like the kind of meeting that you have over Zoom or Skype in a conference room, a meeting where you have five people sitting in a boardroom and then five people calling in to a video platform is a horrible meeting.
Yes.
The people calling in they don't feel like they're involved in the conversation that's happening in the room. They can't read the social cues that are happening in the room. But when everybody is on Zoom or on the digital platform of choice, it's a completely different thing and everybody is on a level playing field. And I wonder if we can get some of that with conferences now. If there's going to be really a chance for one person who's not Bill Gates to be giving a keynote and to get just as much attention as, Bill Gates would be getting if there are 10,000 people in the room when there are only 500 people in the room, I think it'll have a really leveling effect.
Are you doing I have Zoom fatigue. Are you doing lot of your work now on Zoom?
I do an incredible amount of my work on Zoom, but almost all of my one-on-one work I now do just on the phone.
Oh, interesting. Just audio.
Just audio. I actually find that it's almost easier to concentrate with just audio and to really like home in on the sound and the words being spoken and not getting as wrapped up in what people are doing or what's going on in their background. Obviously, that's different when you have to share screens.
Right. That's
so
an interesting
if you have
idea.
To work on something together, then you need that Zoom setting or something similar. But when it's just about having a conversation, more and more, I'm like, please just call me.
See, I ask you because Daniel and Lisa and to a certain extent, we work from home. We don't, is our, you know, we're just, our life hasn't changed at all.
Nope.
But I think, especially because of your position, Lindsay, as a senior vice president, you've spent a lot of time in conference rooms, one-on-ones.
A lot.
Yeah.
And what has been interesting in our experience is that we really haven't missed a beat. I mean, journalism happens from everywhere and always has. So in that sense, we were very well set up to deal with the situation. But what I've been really impressed by is the ability for people across lots of different departments, business settings, you know, business intelligence, finance. Everybody has been working extremely well together. And I don't feel like we really missed a beat. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have so many options for how we communicate with each other in this moment. It's been fascinating.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time thinking about how, okay, obviously, we never wanted this to happen. We never want this to happen again. It's a terrible situation. But we are so much better able to handle it now than we would have been 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost as if we were preparing for this in many respects, you know, Zoom and all of these, you know, Meet and Zoom and Skype and all of these things are relatively recent inventions. I remember, and I mentioned this before, in 1965 when I was a kid, went to the New York World's Fair, and AT&T had a, you know, TV phone. And this in the future, all your phone calls will be video phone calls. And I remember 10, 20 years later, 2001, it came out in the 70s, where he went, Floyd went to Mars or the moon, and he calls his family, and there's the kid, and they're having a birthday party on a big screen in a phone booth. And it seemed like the future, but it never caught on because nobody really wanted to put on makeup and get pants on and stuff for a phone call. So it just never caught on. Except now, I think this is a flip moment and a watershed moment where we're just going to expect all phone calls to be video. I think it's interesting that you're not as productive in video and you've
it depends on the setting. I find that when I need to have a really intricate conversation with somebody that doesn't require any visuals, I think audio can be
you can definitely focus better. I agree with you. Yeah, the visuals are distracting.
I've spent some time talking with a friend about who's read Infinite Jest. I'm not suggesting that you should have. It takes a year.
Oh my God. I've read it. I've started it 20 times. I've gotten this far. It's a great book.
At some point in Infinite Jest, David Foster Wallace predicts
this
a lot of what's going on.
Oh, I got to finish it.
Not from a pandemic standpoint, but from a video conference standpoint. There's a whole storyline about people having a sort of a video machine like the one you're describing, a very sort of a sci-fi,
right?
But basically FaceTime. And then a whole sub-economy grows up around people who make masks that look just like you that you can put in front of the camera so that you can do things like pick your toenails while you're on the video call, but seems like you're there.
That's what people are doing.
I know.
Well, Scott Hanselman actually did it during his keynote at Build. He got up and left, and he was still there.
Yeah.
Wow. Now I'm going to have to finish that again or try
to. Good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
I'll wait for the movie, the HBO series.
Oh, man. It's a great novel, and every time I start it, I think I should really finish this. But I have yet to find a way to get through it. It's interesting because at the same time as this has brought video calling to the forefront, it's hurt some technologies. Obviously, Face ID is not as useful when you're wearing a mask. I wish I had Touch ID on my iPhone. In fact, I went back to the iPhone SE because it has Touch ID. It's perfect for masks. You can unlock it even when you're wearing a mask. But also, I think this is going to hurt. And we were talking about this today with Sam Abelsamid, our car guy on the radio show. it might hurt the future of autonomous vehicles and especially ride sharing, because nobody wants to ride an Uber or a Lyft these days.
I think
it's gonna be a long road back.
Yeah. Go ahead, Daniel.
I think some of that will pass.
You think we'll just get over it? We'll go back to the normal?
Yeah, well, it all, I mean, obviously depends if they get a vaccine or treatment, right, for this.
I feel like we're traumatized. And that trauma doesn't go away even if there's no rationale for it. You know what I mean?
Possibly. I mean, I'm more concerned about movie theaters. Like, I really wonder how movie theaters are going to survive. And so it really is an interesting time to think about. And that's where the work from home stuff is really fascinating. And Nadella talked about that, too, that, you know, more has happened in the last 2 months than in the last, you know, 5-10 years of this. And you're right. All these companies have been pushing towards this, although we've seen pushback, too. Right. IBM famously made everybody work from home or a large portion of their company. And then they reversed it and they said, all right, you got to all come back to work. This was all before the pandemic, right, of course. So there's been this kind of, you know, pull and tug regarding work from home, whether or not it's effective or not. But now everybody's been pushed into it. And you have a lot of companies, you know, Twitter, who, you know, come out and said that, you know, we're going to remain work from home. Microsoft is doing a lot of it as well. And it as good as the technology is, it's also revealing a lot of holes in the game as well. So that's what's going to be really interesting to see how companies pivot now to solve these problems, including this idea of like Zoom fatigue, video fatigue. Now everybody needs to do a video call. So how do you solve that? One area that's been really sort of underplayed, but because it's still too early, I think, is, of course, virtual reality to augmented reality. And I think that could solve, you know, we saw Microsoft 2 years ago, I believe, show off like, was it Holoportation, where you put on the HoloLens and where they had different cameras and you could actually kind of, you know, be as a hologram in someone's room and talk to them physically. Now, we're still years from that, but
it's going to take another pandemic before we get accept that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to think about.
Norms.
Well, go ahead. Yeah. Talk about that, Lisa. That's interesting. What do you mean?
The reason I say generational norms is you're talking about the shift to, say, video conferencing. But if you look at people under 30, they have been sending each other Snapchats and communicating via images for nearly a decade. And so for them, going to video conferencing is a logical next step. And they're the same people who have been driving the idea of the fluid workspace that we discussed earlier, because these are kids who went through an entire school system using Google Docs and Google Tools, where they grew up with a model that all of their work would be reviewed by other people as they were doing it. It would be, and it was a really collaborative, iterative model of work. And there have been people who study the workplace who have talked about there are real generational shifts in how folks who went into the workplace in the 70s, 80s, and 90s regard task flow compared to people who have come in, having come up on say, the Google Docs model. And I think we're going to see the same thing when it comes to teleworking and having Zoom fatigue and things like that, because if you had a method of work that's primarily self-contained and you've got these very structured communications that are either face-to-face or on the phone, you're probably not going to be used to the always-on visually stimulating modes like Zoom calls or image chats and things like that. Whereas for kids who have grown up with this is their normal.
We're going to have the snap workplace, aren't we?
I have a kind of a different take on that, which is that I think that a lot of these kids are very able to be like three different versions of themselves at the same time. So there's the version that you're putting on Snapchat, and then there's the version on Discord, which is mostly voice. And you're doing those things concurrently, and they're very, very able to show only part of themselves, and it's the part that they choose. And I actually think that the resistance to any sort of virtual appearance, like the stuff that Facebook and Oculus are most certainly working on, the ability to let you show up in a room with your friends, I think that the resistance to that might be, if I have to show up physically, whether it's in a physically virtually or physically, I have to be much more aware, and it takes like cognitive load to think about how you look on camera, what your facial expressions are, whether you're responding to somebody when they're talking to you and your body and your affect is responding. And I think that it takes more work. And that's part of the reason people get Zoom fatigue, because they are they're tired.
But isn't that what you do in real life, Lindsay? I mean, how is that different
from there? Because you have to spend a lot. Yeah,
Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, yeah, I think that is what you do in real life. And that's part of the reason, you know, like the teenagers that I live with sometimes would be like, why don't, before the pandemic, hey, why don't you go hang out with your friends? And they kind of look at you as askance and go, I am.
Yeah, I our 17-year-old will have friends over and then they'll all go home so they can play a game together. Because they can't do it in meat space.
My niece is 22. My nephews are younger. They're both teenagers. And it's been really interesting watching every family gathering at the same time they're talking to us in person. They all have their phones open because they're Snapchatting their friends constantly at the same time, too. It's fascinating to me because it's parallel socialization in a way.
Yeah.
And Lindsay,
we used to have parallel play
that's going on with it.
Yeah, when kids are little, they parallel play. When they're really little, like a 2-year-olds, they sit there and they're playing with each other, but they're doing different things. Now they've grown up and they're doing it in real life.
No, it's fascinating. They switch modes in real time, though. It was so much. It's so fascinating to watch them do it and to realize that their relationship, the way they talk to people compared to the way they talk or communicate online with their friends, whether it's through texts or emojis or Snapchats. I think that kind of mode switching, it's exhausting, but they're habituated to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we're probably going to see a lot more of.
This is a deep topic. I want to talk more about it, but I want to take a break. But I think this is interesting that in a way the quarantine and the pandemic have crystallized all. It's almost as if, when you make rock candy, you know, you have a super saturated liquid with sugar in it and you drop one bit of sugar in it and it all crystallizes instantly. I feel like the pandemic did that. It was a catalyst that's brought on a reaction that all this stuff that was just waiting to happen has happened. It's fascinating to think about the new normal and what it's going to look like. But we do need to take a break. We will. We got a great panel. Man, we're going to get deep and get going on this one. Daniel Rubino from Windows Central. He's executive editor there. Look for his new review of those giant gauges he's wearing in his ear. It's always great to have Lisa Schmeiser here from IT Pro Today. I always want to say Windows IT Pro Today, but IT Pro Today. It's mostly Windows, right? That might change, though. You might have to start doing some Linux stuff.
We do. We actually do have a really good open source writer, Christine Hall. So we cover that. And in following Microsoft's cue, we're moving away from assuming that enterprise computing is predicated on an operating system and looking more at application platforms as the basis for it.
Yeah, that's true. Also here, Senior Vice President for Content Strategy at Viacom CBS. I love saying that, Lindsay Turrentine. I note that Lindsay have finished Infinite Jest, as did Carson, our producer, both Harvard graduates. So I think that tells you something. Me, the Yale dropout, I only got it about page 8.
You also dropped out of Infinite Jest.
I drop out of everything. I never finish anything. I've been here 15 years. I can't believe it. It's like, what is going on? I'm suddenly finishing things. Our show today is brought, maybe not, maybe it's not done yet. Our show today is brought to you by Epson. I am a fan of our Epson EcoTank printers. These days, as you're working from home, you got the kids home, they're doing their homework. That printer's working a lot harder. The last thing you want to worry about is running out of ink. And the beauty of the Epson EcoTank, that's the printer that makes this so easy. Supersized, easy to fill tanks. It comes when you buy it with a ridiculous amount of ink, thousands of pages worth of ink in most average use cases, although we're not average anymore, but 2 years. I'm still using the set. I bought a second ink set so I'd be ready, and I'm still using the original set with our EcoTank, and it's been almost 2 years, thousands of pages. So, you know, in the middle of a print job, you know, the kids printing out the report or whatever, no more rushing to the store to replace an ink cartridge in between jobs. You can kiss expensive ink cartridges goodbye. EcoTank is changing the way people print. Look at Shaq there. That's cute. He makes that printer look really small, doesn't he? go ahead and print all your work reports, your task lists, your kids' homework assignments in beautiful color, too. The kids want the color. EcoTank makes it easy. Add it to your online shopping list. So, like Shaq, you too could just fill and chill. Check out Epson EcoTank printers. They're at Best Buy, Office Depot, Office Max, Staples, and, of course, Epson.com/EcoTank, Leo. E-P-S-O-N. I've been using Epson printers since I first got a computer, going back to my MX-80 with a tractor feed And what I love about Epson is they've just kept up with the times, and I think the EcoTank is the best printer made. EPSON.com/EcoTankLeo. Epson, exceed your vision. They actually have different sizes. It's just his hand is so big. I don't know. It's hard to tell. It looks like you could palm that printer and just pick it up and throw it. He's a big guy. You brought this up earlier, Daniel. Twitter says, you know what? Nobody's going to have to come in and again, ever again. That's it. We're all going to work from home. Facebook said the same thing. But then Mark Zuckerberg this week said, but we may, this was shocking to me. We may adjust your salary depending on where you live. I think a lot of Silicon Valley workers are saying, great, I can move to Montana, buy an estate for the price of the rent of my one-bedroom apartment in Silicon Valley and still make the same money. But Mark's saying, well, we're going to take that into – come on, Mark.
That's ridiculous.
You've got enough that money.
Is it though? Is it ridiculous? Most salaries are usually pegged to the geographic location.
I think in this case, your salary should be pegged to your value to the company.
Yeah.
And engineers in companies like Facebook are worth a lot of money. The risk of doing that is that that engineer is going to say, well, yeah, great. I'll go to Google. Will they pay me what I'm worth?
I think that the real difficult thing here is asking people to take a pay cut.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
You have been given an assigned value that you've internalized, I would assume. And I think it's just, it's a big ask.
It's
not the first time this has happened, though. I mean, I don't know, during the first dot-com collapse, I remember companies doing this and moving jobs to like India and saying, hey, you can move to India and take an Indian salary.
Yeah, we'll pay you in rupees. It's great. You're going to love it.
Well, this is the thing I kept seeing on Twitter is everybody was saying, oh, this is going to be the end of the California real estate market. This is the end of Silicon Valley because now the talent can go anywhere and they'll still pull down these amazing prices. And I thought, does nobody remember outsourcing?
Because
a company in a fair and just world, a company should pay employees by value, but they're always going to be looking at, you know, employee compensation as an expense to be managed. And if they can find a way to manage it,
that's true.
They'll do that.
In a perfect world, I would value our employees by what they bring us. But we certainly do consider the fact, well, we're living in Petaluma, so we don't have to pay them as much as if we were living in San Francisco. It's one of the reasons, it's one of the reasons our studios are in Petaluma. The rent's less, the salaries can be less because you can live well in Petaluma. But I think I don't know. This is one of the reasons women get paid less, as you know, 82 cents on the dollar, because people still think, well, the man's got to support a family, so we got to pay him more. I mean, that's old school thinking. That's not good.
I was going to say about the pay cut. Like, I can understand maybe going forward, they're going to be hiring people to be like basing the salary on something else. But I think to ask existing employees to take a pay cut because you're not going to live in an expensive area. I think that's really that's weird.
I also wonder if this is really going to happen. If people are going to, what's the first thing Marissa Meyer did when she went to Yahoo? She told all the work from home employees, you're coming in, you're coming to work. And I think there is still a very persistent thought that people who are working from home are not working as hard as people were in the office. There's also the value of having coworkers, especially if you're an engineer or a coder, having colleagues that you can talk to during the workday.
Right.
And that's one of the things Microsoft showed, I thought, in great detail. Hanselman was showing that, is pair programming and ways to work to collaborate, even though you're not in the same space. But that's never
going to be... Isn't this sort of a live A/B test right now?
I guess it is.
Companies continue to be as productive as they were, and I assume that that will vary by specialty and company and tools that they use. But if a company does find that their workforce is just as productive working from home, that sort of dispels the whole notion that you're not as productive when you work from home. And there will, in theory, be no argument against that.
We're in no hurry to bring our employees back. Most of the employees are working from home, including many of our hosts. Because the virus is still there. It didn't go away. So we're going to continue to shelter in place. But also, it does seem to be working. We are able to get it done. In fact, one of the things engineering-wise we've been looking at is moving some of our stuff to the cloud so that people can, you know, editors and so forth, continue to work from home effectively.
I think every field is going to have to evaluate what works and what doesn't. And I think it's wrong to assume, of course, and not that anyone is, that this work from home will work for everyone, right? Like in every, that's not going to be the case. And there will be some jobs where they will benefit from being in person. And that's where you get into this idea of like even just having an office and you rotate employees in and out of it for periods of time. So maybe you don't go to the office 5 days a week. You only come in 1 or 2 days and you can. So there's going to be a lot of experimentation here once things start to return a little bit back to normal. And I think every company is going to have to figure that out. Even in our company, we're owned by Future now, Future PLC.
Oh, that's right.
And they still. Yeah, and they still have offices. They have offices in New York City, downtown Manhattan.
But they're sales offices, aren't they?
No, they have offices
editorial?
Where...
Editorial?
No, yeah, the writers go in. Editorial offices in New York City. My husband works... My husband's a senior editor at Tom's Guide. And although he works from home on the West Coast...
That's interesting.
The rest of his team is on the East Coast in New York. And they
If there's one thing you could do virtually, it's be a tech journalist, right?
And that's where, like, they bought Mobile Nations, we were all virtual. We didn't have any offices. Right. And we've been working. That's one that made our company so valuable was the fact we had no overhead. And now they're starting to catch on to this. They're like, do we really need to reopen all these offices? And so we're like, why? Why do you need to go to an office to do this job, right? Yeah. For sales,
Ars Technica had a great article like a month and a half ago where they basically laid out, here's how our virtual office works. It was even before we sheltered in place. And they had all their best practices. And the team I'm on, we've been 100% remote and geographically dispersed for like 4 years now. Yeah. And it's worked out well. That said, I will say there is something for being able to meet in person and have meetings where you can bounce ideas off each other and establish and reinforce rapport with somebody.
Yeah.
So I think there's always going to be an opportunity to there will always be a space for dedicated workspaces. There will always be, I think companies will probably try to carve out some sort of working environment to foster those kind of opportunities. But I would be really surprised if a lot of companies in the Bay Area where real estate is very expensive are not taking a good hard look and trying to come up with hybrid models that let them get the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Go ahead.
The thing I'm thinking about with remote work is I had a friend who interviewed for a job recently and she got the offer. The job's based in Ithaca and they gave her the salary and she said, I can't live on that. And they said, well, why not? This is competitive for Ithaca. And she said, well, I don't live in Ithaca. And they said, that sounds like a you problem, not an us problem.
Move to Ithaca. Move to Ithaca, they said. But, it only snows half the year, they said. Yeah,
but this I think this is the thing is right now I've seen a lot of Twitter threads where everybody is like, oh, you know, everyone's got to have Silicon Valley type salaries and then they'll just spread across the country and boost other metros and it's the end of the superstar city and so on and so forth. And I kept thinking it's going to work the other way, too, where you'll have other employers in other parts of the country offering these salaries, but they're still going to tie them pretty heavily to the local economy because that's just kind of how they work with their operating expenses. It doesn't make sense to be an engineering firm in a non-Silicon Valley type area where you live and have to carry the kind of overhead you'd be expected to carry in Silicon Valley. That may not be the best way for you to do business.
I think the other positive effect it's going to have for engineering specifically is that I feel like, you know, the Bay Area was essentially out of engineers. Yeah. Simply not enough employees to come into offices. And so I think, you know, salary aside, the ability to recruit engineers who maybe didn't want to move to the Bay Area, had a family life somewhere else, but are extremely qualified will be a boon, especially if a lot of large companies are being forced to sort out how to make remote work when it wasn't previously.
So Lindsay, my question to you is one of the deterrents I've heard from engineers when it comes to the Bay Area is they don't like the workaholic lifestyle or the expectation that a 75-hour work week is the bog standard. So if you do get a chance to widen your recruitment pool and you're able to pull from other, you know, talented people all over the country, do you think there's the possibility that the culture of Silicon Valley firms might be affected simply because they're going to have a workforce that's resistant to some of the cultural expectations that we take for granted around here?
I think that's really hard to know, but I will say that I hope that it changes. Yeah. And I think that there, it could go a couple of different ways. And like with anything else, it may depend on the company and the culture of the company in question. But I do think that this time and this experiment that we're in right now, like it or not, will help us sort out how we draw boundaries as a corporation, how individuals draw boundaries around the workday. We're sort of being forced to, because we could in this moment work 200 hours a week and there's really nothing to stop us. And so I think people are going to develop their coping mechanisms. On the other hand, humans are humans and some will work themselves to death and some won't work enough. And that may just be the same no matter where you work.
That's the cynic in me saying, oh, Jack Dorsey's just saying, yeah, work from home. We'll expect 90 hours now a week. You know, you're always working. You're working from home. You're always on the job. So that's that is a real risk.
There's something you said, though, from the savings of not having to go to an office. I mean, I wake up in the morning, I roll into my job in 5 minutes. Like, there's no, without commuting, without these massive lunch breaks and some of these forced meetings, and people can be more productive, but it does depend on the individual too. A lot of people work from home, lots of distractions, and you know, that's what's going to change with, you know, some people can't adjust to this lifestyle. So that's going to be an interesting thing going forward, I think, for people and how they get evaluated on work and whether or not they can actually, you know, handle working from home. But there's something to be said from the lack of wasted time that people aren't being actually productive that counts as going to work, you know? So I think that's really interesting.
The distractions vary, because at work, you've got people bugging you. At home, you've got a ham sandwich talking to you from the refrigerator.
You've got homeschooling.
Well, and that's hard for, what you don't want is the kids home at the same time as you are. Yeah. But if the kids had a work day where they went to work, i.e. school, and you could stay home, that wouldn't be that bad, would it? I mean, it's pretty
like
good.
No, honey, staying home and working in your sweatpants is a grown-up privilege. So work hard.
You have to earn that. You have to earn that, kid. Sometimes I feel like COVID is Mother Nature's way of saying, you got to fix the climate crisis, because the air is clean. The cars aren't on the road. It is clear there's a huge cost to commuting. There's a personal cost, but there's a societal cost. There's an ecological cost.
Just stress.
And stress. True. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard a couple people say, I miss my commute.
Well, that's
my commute was when I listened to
Infinite Jest. That's right. The only way you're ever going to finish Infinite Jest is with your 4-hour commute. Clearly.
Yeah, or catch up with your family listen to music in your car. I'm not saying that those things are good things for society, but it's such an individual response.
No, I agree.
Some people miss that so much, and some people are so thrilled to have it be gone. And probably most of us would like a hybrid.
Well, you need me time. So what you can do is carve out me time. It doesn't involve being in a car. Or you could just go in the garage and sit in your car. And weep.
I've been doing
some silently
car because I can't get privacy anywhere else. I'll be like,
go in your car. Weep. I miss my commute. I miss your car. I did not realize this, but apparently it wasn't just the RGV2CW message. There were Easter eggs throughout all the build streams. Daniel, were you aware of that? They were even to the point where they were coordinating their polo shirts to be Microsoft green, blue, and red.
Oh, wow.
I didn't catch that, but Hanselman told The Verge, we had scripts and storyboards. We put it on like it was an hour of television. There was the bouncing Amiga ball in one of the screens during the build event. They were doing all sorts of stuff that only nerds would notice. Scott had a program that was written, an app that was written by Microsoft called Presence Light, that changed his Hue light bulbs to match his desktop theme. I mean, there was a lot of stuff like that. That was kind of wild. You probably noticed it because, you know, that's your
job. I don't get into that stuff. I don't care about Easter eggs. I don't care about nerdy jokes. I'm there for the actual content. I'm glad they did that. And that goes to, again, why I felt like there was a lot of talent that got this to be entertaining for people, because a lot of people do enjoy that. For myself, though, I rolled my eyes at it. I was like, I don't really care, but I'm a cynic. And
yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's just me, because I'm kind of a geeky guy. I kind of enjoy the silliness, the geeky, the Easter
eggs.
Every
time there's a reference to Kanto, so.
Yeah, exactly. You know me. You know me so well. I thought it was very good. I hope that this is a parallel issue, too, because conferences, one of the things people miss from conferences is the face-to-face.
Sure.
I think what might happen for both work at home and conferences is you carve out time for the face-to-face. You have a special, you know, a conference is just face-to-face. And maybe people pay extra to go to build that's just face-to-face, and the rest of it, everybody can stay home and watch. Or your company has Friday, you know, casual day where everybody comes to the office and you have a barbecue and you get some of that collaborative juices going. I think it's possible maybe that's how an adaptation we'd make to that.
I think that that's absolutely feasible. One of the other things that's really interesting is, with COVID specifically, is this idea that it seems like it's becoming more and more clear that indoor transmission is
right.
Much
that's the
more
problem. Yeah.
Indoors is bad.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Outdoors is less bad.
Right.
Although you should still be very careful. Please wear a mask. But I've been thinking about how this affects different parts of the United States. You know, when I think about my office in the Bay Area and things that we could do collaboratively over time, we might choose to do some of it outside. Manhattan is a different story.
Yeah.
And the weather will affect our ability to meet and greet and collaborate outdoors. And is that an advantage for places with more temperate weather just during this next year or two when we're trying to make our way through this?
I think you could meet at the hot dog cart.
Get some peanuts.
Every time I go to New York, I get those roasted caramelized peanuts. I just love those.
So good.
Those are so good. And just walk around with those. And then if you have a little extra to spend, you can get the cashews and really live it up. That's luxury. Are you using, let me ask you, Lindsay, if you're using Zoom at Viacom CBS.
Yes, we're using Zoom primarily. I mean, we use different things for different situations. Sometimes we'll use built-in Google tech, but primarily Zoom.
How about you, Lisa? Is it a Zoom? Is IT Pro today using Zoom or?
No, Skype? It's Microsoft. Microsoft Teams.
Teams, yeah.
Yeah.
Teams is fine. Teams. There's nothing wrong with Teams. You like Teams?
So the interest, I do, and it's been because it's turned into our de facto collaborative workspace for us to drop drafts of stories that we're right. working on, to share things, right. to keep. We have an off-topic channel that we just keep running and keep up the chatter. The thing I found interesting anecdotally is before the lockdown started, through the company, there was a culture of conference calls where you just, you know, you dial in and you'd listen and you'd be working on your computer as you listened, or you'd be participating as necessary. And now we've gone to all Teams video all the time. So
how about you, Daniel? What does Mobile Nations do?
Yeah, we've been using Slack since 2014, maybe. Like, I mean, whenever Slack came out, we pivoted right to it because we were always remote anyway, and geographically. So that became an important tool. And then we would use often Google Hangouts and then a little bit of Skype. Internally, some of us were using Teams for a while. We do have the Windows Central team was using Teams. And Teams is really good for just dropping in a video call, like right in that chat, which is cool. But now we've got all of Future onto Slack, which that wasn't my choice. I would have preferred Teams, but we do have a bunch of other sites, and everybody enjoys using Slack. So that actually, Future wasn't even using a paid version of Slack, and now they are.
Yeah,
now they're using the free the paid version for it. So, but yeah, we just do Slack, and then. Then we use Telegram for the real chat.
Oh, really? Where, yeah, that's where the good stuff happens, huh?
That's where the employees, where we hang up and, you know, Yeah, we're not going to use no corporate spyware.
No, man. Yeah, we want to use Russian spyware instead. Yeah, much better. Yeah. Yeah, we use Slack as well, and that's part of the problem with Slack is it's too much fun. All the animated GIF activity, and it's really actually quite...
I hate it. I barely use those things. I jump in, here's what I'm doing, I'll answer a question. If someone else posts something, I'll read it. I don't spend... The way I look at it is I have to write all day, and I'm not a great writer, and I don't particularly love it. I'm not going to waste my keyboard fingers on nonsense and Slack. Like, I could be writing a paragraph right now. So I know some people do get distracted with Slack and chatting all day. I turn that stuff off. I don't look at it.
My first experience with Slack was when we were developing our website, and the team in Austin that was... got us on Slack, and they had set up a GIF bot that every time you typed "that's nice," Borat would pop up going "that's nice." And for a while, I didn't know why is Borat how what's going on? I was very disoriented.
Is this a feature?
Is this real life? Am I hallucinating? I don't understand.
It's just IRC for the modern world.
Yeah, well, I like IRC. There's no Borat in our IRC, I got to tell you that right now. Was there concern at CBS Viacom when all the Zoom security issues came up? Was there a move at some point to say maybe we should go somewhere else for our conferencing?
I honestly don't know what happened at the top of the IT food chain. And those discussions, I'm assuming that those discussions happened. We didn't stop using Zoom, but I think different parts, it's a very large organization. So different parts of the organization were using different technologies. We got really fast follow on about the right secure way to pursue a Zoom meeting and kept moving. There wasn't a big moment where we all stopped using it. Although I do have kind of a funny story about my son's school district, which is the Berkeley Unified School District. There was a high school class that basically shut down using Zoom for e-learning because of a security breach or a perceived security breach, which was the story was that it was an adult man who basically took off his clothes and crashed a photography class.
Oh my God.
The reality is, and my son was on this call that shut down Zoom for all of BUSC. It was actually just a kid in the class crashing the Zoom stream with a GIF.
Of course. I know which GIF. Yes.
Yeah.
I know exactly which GIF.
And my son was like, it was actually really funny.
Yeah.
And I don't know why.
That is definitely
a very interesting moment.
That's a generational gap because all the kids knew exactly what happened.
They knew exactly what happened and they were not. I mean, it wasn't appropriate. It's not the right.
No, but they'd all seen that picture many, many, many times. That's pretty funny. That's generational. And the teachers were going, "Oh my God, there's an old man in here."
It was definitely an interesting moment. I mean, I think it caused the district to really sort out what they needed to sort out from a security perspective anyway. So it wasn't all a bad thing.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of learning happening in a lot of places that are not tech savvy.
Yeah.
I mean, all of our employers are pretty savvy. There are a lot of places right now sorting through a lot of questions.
Right. No, and I don't want to downplay it because it is actually a big problem, Zoom bombing. But I think everybody by now has learned. The reason I ask is Zoom has made such a concerted effort to look like they're working hard on security. I'm not sure how much of it's real and how much of it's theater. That's kind of unknown. I mean, they've hired or brought in consultants, some of the biggest names in security. They hired Secure Code Warrior to start locking down the code. They hired the former Yahoo and Facebook security guru, well-respected Alex Stamos. They hired Katie Masouris's company to find zero days. I mean, they've done a lot. They said, we're not going to add any new features. They even missed a boat on a opportunity with Facebook. They were working on something with Facebook and had to stop because they didn't want to work on new features. They just wanted to lock it down. But I don't know. I mean, it's great PR. They convinced, I think, the world, oh, yeah, we care about security and we're going to work on it. I don't know how much of a difference it made. It's not completely
Well, so much of this comes down to human error and behavior. Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, if people are going to openly distribute, if they want their Zoom call to be open and they're going to send a URL around.
Right. People are going to join it.
People are going to join it. And yeah, you have to understand the risks. I think they've done a pretty good job communicating about the risks. At a certain point, people often, as we know, will sacrifice their privacy for convenience.
Right.
And I am honestly not sure that any company can do much about that.
Well, my wife, we use Zoom. We use a lot of different things, Zoom, Google Meet, and Slack. But my wife was perturbed because we use Zoom mostly with outside clients, sales calls and things like that, because they understand how to use it. And when Zoom changed it so you had to have a password, it was annoying to her. It's like, I don't want a password. I want everybody
I'll
to be.
I'll take the risk.
Yeah, I'll take the risk. I'll take the risk. And so as often is the case, making something more secure sometimes makes it less convenient, less fun. Yeah. Let's take a little time out. Great panel today. You guys are fantastic. We want to talk, though, about our fine sponsor, the folks at IT Pro TV. Many of our listeners are IT Pro TV customers or former customers. A lot of you work in IT. I know that because every time I go to an IT Pro TV event, people say hi to Steve Gibson for me. So I know that you already probably know about IT Pro TV. But if you don't, I want to tell you, this is a great way to get an IT career, to improve your IT chops. And if it's stuff, if you like IT, it's the best way because they were really inspired by what we did here at Twit and what Tech TV did. They built these beautiful live streaming studios. I was actually quite jealous that they're fantastic looking. They do 9 to 5 Monday through Friday because it's not something you can just make a video and then leave it. You have to continually update them because technologies change, new versions come out. And so they have the latest informational videos, teaching videos, so that you can get the IT job you want or keep the IT job you want or get a better IT job. It's a great way if you're trying to get started. There's those. I love these beautiful studios. It's a great. That's Don right there, isn't it? Or yeah. It's a great way to get your start as an IT career because they have learning coaches who will help you navigate your career roadmap. They'll actually help you figure out which, you know, IT is not monolithic. There's all different kinds of IT careers. They'll help you figure out which one is right for you. You sign up for a premium membership and let an expert guide you. You'll start by setting goals. Your coach will implement an IT training program specifically to help you reach them. They have an extensive IT career path library that can assist you in learning more about the different IT careers. So is it if it's entry-level IT or cybersecurity or networking or, you know, fixing computers, whatever it is you like and you're interested in, you can learn the ins and outs of them as a jumping off point. So you'll know exactly what that job entails, what you'll be doing, how much you can make at that job. That's important. And once your training is complete, IT Pro TV takes it a step further. They help you find the career of your dreams. They'll help you with placement too. IT Pro TV does the same thing for teams as well. They have a learning coach for teams. So if you have a team, and a lot of teams at some of the biggest companies in the world use IT Pro TV to keep their IT teams up to date and give them new skills. If you've got a team and you're using IT Pro TV, those learning coaches are great because they can, and if you've got a corporate premium membership, they can help you figure out which people should learn which skills, which ones are the most suited for it. You notice there the A+, the Security Plus, the Network Plus certifications. Those are some of the most in-demand certifications. They come from CompTIA. IT Pro TV is the official video training partner for CompTIA. They have 12 on-demand courses for CompTIA certs. Now is a great time to maximize the potential of your team and help them get the certs they need to become successful. Now is a great time to get a career in IT. That's one thing. Our IT guy, Russell, is busier than ever. He's got more work during the quarantine. I'll tell you what a great job. Let IT Pro TV guide you into the IT career that's best for you. Go to itpro.tv/twit. Use the code TWIT30. Get 30% off all consumer subscriptions as long as you stay active. Why waste the time you've got right now? You can watch on your big screen TV. You can do it on your computer, on your phone. They've got apps for Roku, Apple TV. You can listen in the car. IT Pro TV is everywhere. Don't waste this moment. Get a great career in IT. ITPro.tv/TWIT. Use the offer code TWIT30 for an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. Don't forget that offer code TWIT30. Thank you, IT Pro TV. We've been with them since they started, and they've always been a great partner to work with, and we appreciate your continued partnership during this crisis. And I thank you, the TWIT listeners, for using that offer code and that special URL. Let them know you saw it here on This Week in Tech. We had a great week on This Week in Tech. You know what I didn't see? We did a werewolf variation called, Find the Hacker on our TWIT After Hours. Let's take a look. We had a lot of fun this week. Here's a little entertaining video we've made for you.
Previously on TWIT.
Well, hello there. I am Stephanie Studebaker, and I have been called in from the corporate office. You see, we have determined that this here company has been hacked, and somebody here was responsible for taking some very important, very secret information.
Hands on Mac.
This week, I'm going to show you the single most important thing you can do to secure your Macintosh.
TWIT News.
So this is the first number of developer conferences that will be streamed. Microsoft Build 2020, the first virtual developer conference.
Good morning and welcome to Build.
All about Android.
So the OnePlus 8 Pro has a color filter camera on it, right? But it was perplexing because a lot of people thought it was an X-ray camera, which it is not.
TWIT, technology for your eyes and ear holes.
There's a perfect example of a company jumping the wrong way. They had a color filter, and so you could kind of see, because it would filter out the color and say the Apple TV, so you'd be able to see the electronics without the color. And they're taking it out because people thought, they're going to think it's an X-ray camera. We can't let that happen. So they're taking it out. That's just silly. That's just, I don't believe it. Jeez Louise. Speaking of failing technology, students are failing AP tests because they're using their iPhone to take pictures. And of course, the iPhone uses this high efficiency image codec, and the AP exam apparently can't understand it. So when you attempt to upload it to the testing portal, at least this is the experience of a high school senior in Los Angeles. He just completed his English literature and comp test last week. He snapped a photo of a written answer with his iPhone. It broke the portal. It stopped responding. His time ran out, and he failed the test.
So my son took two AP tests in the last 2 weeks.
Yes.
And I got to say, he read that story and was like, the College Board is the worst. Why couldn't they figure this out? This is so dumb. But on the other hand, I have a lot of, I'm not sure I can call it empathy, but sympathy for the College Board because, gosh, this scenario in which students could not take proctored exams, well,
that's hard.
Definitely
yeah.
A feasible one. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that the College Board isn't hiring like world-class engineers. They probably can't pay a world-class salary. And all of a sudden, they have a month and a half to completely refactor the way that they test basically every college-bound student in the country. And they have to account for handwritten tests.
Right.
That's crazy. Anyway.
It is the case that the College Board tweeted the recommendation that you change the settings on your camera from hike to JPEG. How could they have missed that tweet? No, you're right. I don't want to bash on the College Board. It's, all struggling.
I mean, people are bashing the College Board. It's and have been for long before
yes.
this pandemic.
Not the most sophisticated.
But it's a very strange situation yeah. for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. One senior who was quoted by The Verge, he has to remain anonymous, said that the College Board tweet went out a few minutes before his physics test began. He says no one taking the AP physics test would have been able to see it because we were already logged in. So thanks for the tweet. But anyway, I feel bad. I feel bad in general for high school seniors and college seniors. This has been a rotten graduation Rotten 2020. Although I have to say, my heart is warmed. I don't know how Lindsay, your senior feels, but my heart is warmed by all the signs everywhere congratulating 2020 graduates. I think people feel bad for them; they don't get to walk.
It stinks. He's a junior.
Oh, he's a junior.
So he's got one more year. Okay. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what the world is like.
No, by then. It'll be fine a year from now.
But I will say that the remote learning, like the inequities that have come out of remote learning are huge. So a lot of private schools have been able to weather this pretty easily. And a lot of public schools, my mom the other day was like, why aren't they absolutely required to be sitting in an online class, you know, 3 days a week, for instance? And I had to explain that, well, in a large urban district, there are a lot of kids who still don't have access to a computer. I think BUSD has handed out many hundreds of hotspots just to give some kids internet access so that they could learn. So big public school districts have been completely unable to make remote classes required. And as a result, the teaching is just, it's a shadow of what it used to be, not because these teachers aren't dedicated, but because they literally cannot reach their students.
Do you feel like the students you have in living with you are basically losing a year or a semester?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it is by no fault of the district. I mean,
no.
I'm sure your district is perfect, but
your kids are in a highly technical, highly wired house. They've got all the tools they need. Imagine the kids who aren't.
Absolutely. My kids have a fiber connection, and so that they can upload anything that they need to. But you know, I will say that it's been interesting to watch the reaction overall, even with very technically savvy families, to this kind of remote learning. The feedback that I've gotten from my friends and from my kids is that it is just extremely hard to motivate.
Yeah.
When every day looks the same and when you're not there with your peers. And if you're really into like AP US history,
right?
But what you're into is the conversation about US history in the classroom.
Yep.
And that's gone.
Yep.
They're just staring out the window.
Yeah. I completely
get a
sympathize.
Lot of feedback on Zoom fatigue and
yeah.
And
Lisa, how's your daughter doing?
A lot of the issues that Lindsay mentioned, we've had in Alameda as well. I know for our school personally, we didn't start online instruction for 2 weeks because our elementary school wanted to wait until every student in the school had both a Chromebook and regular guaranteed internet access. So they did regular technology surveys, arranged for drop-offs and pickups, arranged for internet access, and then we were able to start. We started off with the awareness that not every kid was going to have an equal situation going into this to begin with. My daughter is 9, and what has been the predominant theme that runs through this is she really misses working with her peers.
Yeah, of course.
There's a lot of collaborative learning that goes on at that age. And for all that they have little breakout groups in Zoom, that's not the same thing as being able to like bend over a paper with two or three other kids and puzzle things out back and forth. And they try really hard over Zoom. And the teachers do a lot of small group work too. I mean, the teachers have really done their best to rise to the challenge, but it's a struggle to remain engaged because you're either spending a lot of time staring at a screen or you're trying to work through a math game, or you're trying to work through a typing test or something like that. And it is very different from a live, living, breathing type school situation where you can maybe take a break, or you can have a friend that can troubleshoot with you if the teacher is busy, or the teacher can come over, or the teacher's aide can come over. It's been a mixed bag.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for the structure.
Any kid with any sort of disability. So imagine a kid who's somewhere on the autism spectrum, who's not going to do well with video chat, who really, you know, probably relies on in-person cues because cues are so hard to read in the first place. Any autistic kids in general are really struggling. And I've heard that from people in the district. It's been very hard to plan for special education for anybody who needs it. You know, technology only gets us so far and then we rely on each other. And when that last part is gone, I think it's been very, very difficult.
And of course, there's.
And I feel really lucky. I have a 9-year-old, so she's able to do a lot of things by herself. I have friends who have much younger kids, and asking a group of kindergartners to focus on Zoom for 20 minutes is just a monumental task. And how are you? So much of kindergarten and first grade is just learning how to be in school. And now these kids don't even have that. There's so
the only good news is everybody's doing it. Everybody's going through this, I think. So there's going to be just a generation, and it's not just the U.S., worldwide, that just, well, we missed a little bit of school when I was a kid. And everybody will. What I worry more maybe a little bit about is the future of higher education. A lot of universities are facing now a crisis. And it's not, I mean, look, it's across the board. Hertz just declared bankruptcy. And of course, that's going to trickle down because car manufacturers depend on fleet sales to big companies like Hertz. And so they're going to be in trouble and on and on and on. But higher education, a lot of universities just aren't in a great position to survive another 6 months of this. And if you're spending, if you're, I mean, imagine you're a Harvard student, you're spending a ton of money to go to Harvard, and all you're doing is taking courses at home. I might take that year off.
Yeah. Well, we're, you know, as the parent of a junior who's kind of sketching out his future, it's hard to know even what the fall matriculation a year from this fall will look like.
Right.
Whether all of the, I mean, if I were going to be starting college this coming fall, I would probably take a year off. What's the impact that has a year from now?
Right.
Yes.
If there's a school left. I mean, Harvard's got a huge endowment. They're going to be left, but there are a ton of, Scott Galloway was on CNN last night saying we're going to see universities disappear. He's a professor at NYU. We're going to see a lot of universities.
Yeah, I read he had a piece in New York Magazine last week where he was saying that and explaining the rationale behind it. Now, one of my nephews is a senior. He got accepted to a UC, and the discussion that he's having with his family, which is ongoing right now.
Gap year.
The question is it worth him enrolling and starting as a UC freshman if his experience is, welcome UC freshman, enjoy your bedroom in your house?
That's not a good idea. And honestly, if you take a gap year, you're not going to be doing the grand tour. You're going to still be in your bedroom. So I don't know what it's going to look like.
Yeah. Or does he defer and go to community college for a couple of years and get his basics taken care of and then try to transfer back into the school? And these are decisions that he had no idea he was going to have to make this year.
Right.
You know?
Right.
He was like, all I had to do was try and get into college. I got into college.
You know what's doing well? Minecraft. Minecraft plays spikes. This is a CNET story. Tops 126 million builders a month. Already the best-selling PC game of all time. I think, what did Microsoft say? They crossed 200 million copies sold. Now 126 million people playing every month. Talk about a smart move on Microsoft's part. And by the way, what a good steward they have been. It's not unusual to see big companies buy properties and let them fall. Microsoft kind of destroyed Nokia. But in this case, they've made Minecraft better and better and better. They've put a lot of effort into making a fantastic product. And I think there's a whole generation that loves Minecraft.
And they're about to launch Minecraft Dungeons, which I've been actually playing.
Oh, have you? Tell me about it, because I'm dying to play it.
It's good. So, like, if you're like me and you appreciate Minecraft, but you kind of don't get it, Minecraft Dungeons is way more approachable. It's a straight up, top down kind of RPG.
So they call it dungeon crawl, right?
You're dungeon crawler, right?
Yeah,
yeah. And it's just it's a classic kind of video game. But the graphics on it, the effects have been really good. The playability is really nice. It's charming. You're still in that Minecraft world with all those characters, but there's kind of like a plot now. They're already planning 2 expansion packs. This isn't like a one-off game. They're looking at this as sort of like Minecraft, which has always been, they keep building on it, right? They're getting RTX support. They're building out. There's the Minecraft education component. Well, they're going to be kind of doing that with Dungeons as well. There's a lot of plans behind this property. I think compared to the other Minecraft, the virtual reality one, this one is way more fun and accessible, so I'm actually pretty excited about it.
It comes out in, what, two days, day after tomorrow?
Yeah.
And you feel like it's pretty playable? It's ready to go?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It's really enjoyable. I think anyone can hop into playing it. There's no building, so there's just game playing.
We have a 17-year-old at home who's played Minecraft since he was 8, probably. I don't know, for as long as it's been around. I'm running right over here, 5 different Minecraft instances. Well, one's my own personal one because I don't like kids messing with my stuff. But but they have several. And it's really fun, and they're totally into it. Yeah, last week I was showing Brianna Wu, who is a game developer. I was showing her what they built, which was mind-boggling. She said, those are actually the exact skills they need to be professional level designers in gaming. I haven't told Michael this. I may never tell him this, but she said, what you're doing in Minecraft is harder than it would be doing it in Unreal Engine. You could get a job doing that stuff. So there's going to be a whole generation of kids who are really good at Minecraft, I guess.
Leo, do you find that do the kids you know play Minecraft with different groups of people? What I find is that, I'm that lady who's just talking about her son all the time. Sorry.
No, anyway, it's social. It is totally social.
It's social, but what he has his gamer friends, and they play hardcore PC games together, and then they're on Discord. And then he has his casual friends who are his, they're also very good friends, but they're more of his arty friends or his, history class friends, and they get on House Party and play Minecraft.
Oh, how interesting.
Oh, so it's like different games for different scenes.
Yeah. No, he does that. It's different. It's absolutely the case. Yeah. There are some kids who want to play Mortal Kombat 11. There are some kids who want to just build stuff. There's absolutely room for both. And yes, it's different groups. It's very interesting. And of course, then there's the competitive gamers, the esports kids, and
I was going to say with Minecraft, because it is different like that. We used to have a show years ago that I had started with some of our writers. And the idea was, what's nice about Minecraft, one, it's very approachable. Anybody can pick it up, whether you're 8 years old or 60 years old. Anyone can jump into it. But it also is casual. Like, you can sit there and have conversations with people while you're walking around and building stuff, versus a first person Call of Duty type game where it's gonna be all action. No one's gonna be like, so did you hear about school today? Like, there's not gonna be that kind of level of engagement. But what's really cool is I almost feel like that level in Minecraft is sort of this idea of like where we're going today, right? We're just talking about with work from home and this idea of people and kids being already used to having these sort of virtual relationships. And you can do that with different levels of gaming. And Minecraft is, I would say, a high level, because you can sit there and really get into conversations with people. And it's already kind of training kids for that new world, which we're in right now.
We used to have a Minecraft show, OMG Craft. Chad Johnson hosted it. They built a whole beautiful Twit City. This is a video that he made in 2013 when he was still at Twit. 7 million views since then. And I'm very happy for Chad. He does it on his own now. He said, at one point, I'd like to do this myself. I think I can make some money at this. And we said, oh, all right. And he is now at 1 million subscribers, OMG Craft. So we're very proud of Chad Johnson, who we still love. 1 million subscribers. And I feel a little bit of proprietary joy for him, because we did start that show way back when in the Twit Cottage. And I have a feeling that one of the reasons he's done so well is he hung in there, but also Minecraft has just taken off. Minecraft is huge. So congratulations, Chad. He used to produce this show. He was one of my producers. Speaking of success, Joe Rogan going to Spotify, the most successful podcaster of all time, according to Joe Rogan. Well, and I believe him. He says he has 190 million downloads a month. That I find a little mind-boggling. I have no reason to doubt it, but it seems like, I mean, that's almost...
Well, he's been doing it for so long, right? I mean, how many of those downloads...
I've been doing it longer than him. That doesn't mean I got 190 million a month. I don't think longevity is the only reason.
Well, he says he has the downloads, but who's audited it?
There's nobody. There's no rating system. But I look, it's pretty clear Joe is the number one podcast in the world. And he I'll tell you who's given him some validity. Spotify just took him over They're going to make the Joe Rogan podcast an exclusive on Spotify. Wall Street Journal estimates that's a deal worth more than $100 million. He is on YouTube, but there will no longer be Joe Rogan shows on YouTube, just excerpts. All of his shows going back 11 years will be on Spotify starting September 1st and at some point before the end of the year. And this is the thing that worries me. It will be exclusive to Spotify. Spotify spent, they said they were, Daniel Ek, their CEO, said they were spending $500 million to acquire podcast networks. And they bought Gimlet. They bought Parcast. They bought Anchor FM. They bought The Ringer. And they are trying to build an exclusive podcast empire. And exclusive is an important word because that makes them more valuable to advertisers. Because if you have to listen on the Spotify app, then advertisers will know exactly who listened, when, for how long. There won't be any, and there's not any good way, as you, I wish you hadn't said it, but there's not a good way, Lisa, as you pointed out, to measure that. We don't know. You know, we can count downloads from our server, but that's about all we can do. RSS podcasts might suffer a little bit if Spotify succeeds. Apple apparently does not want to let Spotify succeed. They're beefing up their podcast operation. And in fact, they apparently are looking for people to hire to run. I don't know if they'll be exclusive, but to run podcasts at Apple. So I'm glad I'm in a growing industry.
I mean, if it goes the way of all video media, it will be exclusive. I mean, the path to profitability is probably exclusivity for all the reasons you mentioned, but also because that's how you guarantee listeners. I mean, if I were a big Joe Rogan fan, which I am not, but I am one of the, yes, I'm one of the Apple Music people. Like, I never got in deep with Spotify, but if I were a big fan, I might be like, okay, well, time to jump ship. I'm going to move over to Spotify. And if enough people do that, it'll be effective.
It's very interesting. I have to say, it's going to be changing. It's become big. It's become more mainstream, hasn't it? It's no longer a hobbyist medium.
It's no different than, like, even with YouTube years ago, people basically creating shows off of YouTube and then big media companies coming in and buying those. But you're seeing this, you know, I think, well, a lot of people are upset about.
That didn't work so well, did it, Daniel?
No, it didn't. Not with those YouTube shows. And, you know, there's been hits and misses there. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with podcasts. I know the thing about podcasts that really drives people nuts is there's a very, very DIY element to it, both in creating the actual show. Anyone can do it, you know, and then build up. But there's also a DIY aspect in terms of listening to it, because you can get any sort of podcast app, subscribe to the RSS feed and download it and control it. And there's been a whole submarket of those kind of apps. And now with, you know, it going to Spotify and, you know, a lot of other podcasts going to Spotify, and I guarantee you Apple and everybody else will start doing this as well, that whole industry is going to die and people are going to lose the control. They're going to go to these specific apps, no different than what we're seeing with video on demand in terms of Amazon and Netflix.
Isn't that a nightmare, though? You don't know where the show you want to watch lives. It's frustrating.
Right. And so this is going to be the same thing that's going to happen there.
Opportunities there. That's a lot.
I'm sorry, Lisa. Yeah. I don't know what's going on with your audio. You're coming and going. So say that again. No.
Say, so think about the directory opportunities, because I don't know about anyone else, but when someone recommends a movie at this point, one of the first things I do is go to a website called Is It Streaming to find out,
right,
is it streaming on any one of those?
And where can I watch it? Yeah,
and
that's kind of where
I don't want podcasting to be, oh, I have to figure out where to get my podcast. I have to go to canihearit.com to find out where I can hear the podcast. That's to me, that's disappointing. Although I guess it's analogous to what happened to blogging, or is it? I mean, maybe not, because
sort of. Remember, you've always had effort for the walled garden model. Remember that this has been something that sort of happens every few years when there's a new media genre that's attracting sufficient engagement and or ad dollars, it's going to get, there's usually a land rush on afterwards to try to create networks or try to create the walled garden or to try to create an exclusive channel and monetize under the premise that people will be willing to pay for it. But on the, I think what I'm getting at is, will it be not great if you're a Joe Rogan fan and you cannot or will not subscribe to Spotify for whatever reason, and you're going to miss out on back shows and archives and this thing that you've loved? Yes, it's going to be bad in the short term, but there are other podcasts. This is an extraordinarily popular podcast, but podcasting doesn't start and end with this guy.
Well, so, and Howard Stern, Howard Stern left radio to go to Sirius. They paid him $500 million over a period of years. He made a lot of money. Yeah. Very good for Howard Stern. Didn't kill radio.
Yeah.
Other things are killing radio.
Yeah. So I thank God we have a content strategist here. So, and by the way, CNET does a ton of podcasts. CBS Interactive does a ton of podcasts. CBS Radio does a ton of the. I imagine some of the content strategy and stuff that you're doing, the strategizing has to do with that. Have you talked a little bit about that in the future of RSS versus exclusive?
We published two new podcasts last week. Yep. The group that I work in did. See? One is about wrestling.
Oh, wow.
And one is called The Cheapskate, which is about getting really good deals. It's Rick Beretta's podcast. He's been writing that column for CNET for probably 15 years.
Yeah.
And now he's doing it as a podcast. It's really good. You guys should listen. But we haven't obviously pursued any sort of exclusivity. And one of the things that's charming about podcasts right now, and I am frankly surprised it took this long for this Joe Rogan style turf war to happen, because it has been such a joy to say, get our podcast on your podcasting
platform. I agree.
And I am shocked that it took this long for this to happen. I don't think that, I think that it will work. I think that, you know, we all know that it's a truism that content is king. And if you have content that you can't get somewhere else, you'll go to that place. And that's why the streaming landscape is so confusing right now.
Right.
And all of the networks have proven that if you have a piece of content that has a huge fan base, they will sign up for one more account to get it. So we haven't gone there yet with the podcast that we're producing in the group that I manage, but I wouldn't be surprised if the industry moves there.
Yeah.
And not slowly.
To be clear, I mean, our podcasts are on Spotify. We actually were a launch partner when Spotify started doing podcasts. We were very glad to be on the stage there with Daniel Ek, but I would never go exclusive to any platform. I wouldn't want to go exclusive to any platform, because kind of my ethos is, well, it should be wherever anybody goes, we should be there. That's good for us.
Not for $100 million.
Well, no. Let me be clear. I'm not stupid.
Remind them a lot of things for $100 million.
I mean, Rogan has said that. He said in the past he would never do that for Spotify because the numbers were too low.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And,
okay.
You know, he actually has like kind of lambasted them in the past about how they treated artists. Something changed, and it's probably that
$100 million changes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's not that bad. Everybody's got a price. It's pretty hard to say no to $100 million. I don't fault Joe. I know absolutely zero faulting of Joe. I'm hoping that Spotify's strategy does not hurt traditional RSS podcasting, because I think there's a lot to be said for this. And it's somewhat freewheeling. You could start a wrestling podcast. You could start a cheapskate show. That's the beauty of it. You know, anybody could start a show and it can do well, because you don't have to make a deal with a content gatekeeper. You can just put it out there. And I want to see it that way. It's kind of like blogging, too. And I want to see it stay.
I think it's
one of the big challenges with podcasts, and it's both leveling and frustrating. And I'm sure you know this, is that if you are just a person who, and this happened with blogging too, if you're a person who just puts it out there and you DIY your content and it's good, it is so hard now to be discovered.
Yes. No, it's
huge. It wasn't 5 years ago
huge
in the
problem.
Podcast world. It's a huge problem now. And I think the one benefit that could come from more structure in the podcast world is discoverability. I mean, you know, Apple has squandered this a little bit, but they do spend some time curating podcasts for the public. That is a little bit of a service. I am surprised that there aren't more services out there further curating the podcast world, but we're missing that guidance. And I think hopefully it'll come from what's happening now in one way or another.
There is something, I mean, it's the same
content
thing.
Content niche to be just developed and exploited. I absolutely agree.
But the same situation on YouTube, there's a million shows on YouTube. It's hard to figure out what to watch, but somehow the cream rises. I mean, some of it is that, you know, like Chad Johnson, he spent years working really hard, producing a ton of great content. And I'm sure it was frustrating and in the beginning and challenging in the beginning, but eventually he built a big audience and now I'm sure he's doing fine. So
starting to see this also play out with esports, you know, with Twitch and Mixer and YouTube all paying large sums of money to game streamers to try to lock in that audience.
Yeah, you bet.
So, you know, we're seeing
didn't
this
PewDiePie
play out
just didn't PewDiePie just
YouTube.
Yeah, he said, "Okay, I'll stay at YouTube." But I think the threat was he was going to go somewhere else. We don't know what the dollar amount was, but it's got to have been huge because he's their number one content guy. It's maturity. It's what happens with maturity in any industry. The money gets in. I'm kind of an old hippie. I like the idea that anybody can do a blog, anybody can do a podcast. You know, that was what the internet changed, was you didn't have gatekeepers anymore. You didn't have to, you know, talk a publisher into publishing your book. You could just self-publish it. You didn't have to talk a record company into producing your record. You could just put it out and you could succeed. Maybe not make a platinum
record.
Anybody
still can. It's just a question of whether you're an audience.
Right.
Yeah, I think that the downside, the flip side of what you're describing, Leo, is that so now that you can self-publish, say, a novel, let's talk about the book industry for a minute. You can self-publish a novel. You probably won't get attention unless you know somebody who knows somebody, or unless there's something so astounding about it that it gets kind of picked up. It used to be that you could talk a publisher into publishing your novel if it was good, and you could go through the traditional routes through an agent, find a publisher. Now it's almost even harder because publishers have been stretched so thin that they go to just where the money is. They're less likely because they have so much data at their hands to take a risk on somebody who's unknown. And it's almost like this flattening had this really good effect for access in the beginning. And now people are finding themselves wishing that having an agent and going the traditional route to a publisher was a guarantee of financial success because it is no longer. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, and users want curation. They want some direction. They want some help finding good stuff. Do you think it's foolish to say, am I just a pie-eyed optimist to say that the if it's good enough, it'll make it, it'll rise to the top? Is that not the case? Are there great records, great musicians, great podcasts, great novels out there that just won't?
There's a ton out there that's undiscovered, and it probably always has been. I mean, that's always been true because we live in a big world.
It's less true now, isn't it?
I think artists are having a hard time getting things like record contracts because the money from a record contract only comes from like a huge hit, and otherwise it just comes from merchandise.
Right.
So it's harder to get over that hump.
I would go in the subway in New York and I would hear the best virtuoso musician down there in the subway. And I would think there must be a million people like this guy or gal, and they don't have a record contract. The difference is you no longer have to have a record contract to be heard. And if you are a virtuoso, you don't have to play in the subway. You can put it on YouTube, or you can even put it on Spotify. You can even put it on Apple Music. And perhaps, if you're that good, generate an audience. That, to me, is still better than the old system.
I think it is, but I think that we're also suffering a little bit from the tyranny of the algorithm.
Well, that's for sure. Thank you, Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, especially in the YouTube world, there are some content creators who are creating really interesting, good stuff. And it's sort of this self-fulfilling prophecy that if it doesn't take off, it doesn't get seen.
Right.
That's the challenge.
And as Lisa, you're right, because there's an opportunity there. Both of you are right. There's an opportunity there to somehow help the cream rise. I don't know if Spotify is the right answer, but there's got to be. That's the problem.
There's always going to be a market for curation because people will not want to, or either they won't want to, or they won't have the time to, or they'll get up in their head about an inability to curate for themselves. And so you still have a lot of blogs that are very popular because they promise to sift through products and find the best ones for you. We still have an entertainment media vertical that reviews things and tells you what to watch because curation's a valuable content niche that could probably stand to expand with the flood of content that comes out. And then there's also going to be discoverability tools. And audience development is another thing too, because, you know, you've talked about how, oh, there's these great musicians you heard on subways. They're playing on subways, and the odds that somebody is going to leap off of the A train and scream, "I must take you down to the Lincoln Center."
That was the dream.
But that's vanishingly small. That's not how you develop. That's not how you would develop your constituency and how you would.
But I don't think that's why they're playing the subway. They're playing the subway for tips. That's how they're making.
I think you're right. Both.
They're hoping that it's like sitting in Schwab's drugstore.
Not enough artists have had to have training or a background in audience development. Like, most of them focus, understandably so, on being artists.
Right.
But if you're in a world where there's just this huge sloshing sea of content and there are algorithms that are self-reinforcing towards certain content trends and you're not already locked into that system, you're now in a position where not only are you a producer and a creator, you have to try to figure out how you're going to also, who are you targeting? How are you targeting them? What are your ways of reaching out? And those aren't always complementary skill sets that people have.
Let me talk about our sponsor, LastPass. LastPass sponsored our studio. We love LastPass. I hope you saw our event where we talked about the future of digital identity with a great panel, including LogMe and CISO Jerry Buchelt and Steve Gibson from the Security Now show and Andrew Keene. We've got another LastPass event coming up this fall. Stay tuned. We'll talk about that. LastPass is a very good partner to have today as we have more and more employees working from home. It's really been a lifesaver for us. You've got to plan for the unexpected. And the beauty of LastPass, I feel very fortunate that we moved to LastPass a few years ago, LastPass Enterprise. I've always used it at home. Initially it was a password manager, but now it's much more. Now it really is about making sure that the right people are using the resources that they're entitled to, keeping control of those things. And when you have employees going home, employees who have access to our bank accounts, to our databases, to our servers, it's important that we secure all of that. LastPass can be deployed quickly in the midst of any event to ensure that your business continues to run smoothly, that every employee that log in is secure. They do it in a lot of ways now, much more than just password management. Single sign-on is a big one. I love this. There are about 1,200 plus single sign-on apps that work with LastPass. I like it because it's more secure, and employees like it because it's easier to use. And IT continues to have control and insight, access to who's accessing what from where. And that's really important. Of course, they have the best password management. They always have. And you get complete oversight of shadow IT, enforceable policies across all password-protected accounts. They've also added some interesting multi-factor authentication. So, of course, you've got biometric authentication on most phones now. But in addition to that, you've got contextual factors like geolocation, IP address that help you make sure the right people are using the right tools. If you're using a VPN, for instance, of course, the VPN is a login. Your employees are using that login. But you can also use LastPass to add multi-factor to that login, making sure that you've got the right people accessing your network. And some of the things LastPass does is so smart. They never send or store the master password. That means LastPass can't access your data. And if they can't, neither can hackers. Encryption happens exclusively at the device level before you sync to LastPass. Only users can decrypt their data only at the device level. And by the way, every device, Windows, Mac, Linux, Android, iOS, I use LastPass everywhere. Password sharing can be done securely and easily, even if employees are at home. I can't recommend LastPass more highly. It is the way to secure your business. I am so glad we're using it, especially now that most of our employees are working from home. You should be using it too. LastPass can make remote work simple and secure. LastPass.com/twit. Find out how they can help your business stay productive. LastPass.com/twit. A great partner in this special time. Special time. And we're coming, you know, the other thing that's booming, thanks to quarantine, is streaming TV. Next week, HBO Max is coming. Even Apple is starting to beef up its lineup on Apple TV Plus by buying older TV shows. It turns out catalog is pretty important on streaming networks. And Apple just spent $70 million to get the new Tom Hanks movie, which was supposed to appear in theaters about now and can't, obviously. Normally producers have been doing is putting them on for $20 rentals. I watched a number of movies that were supposed to come out. We just watched Emma, The Hunt. That was wild. Paid $20 rental, but that we would have paid that much to go see it in the theater. So that was okay. This is, though, interesting. This movie Greyhound, which is all done, will premiere exclusively on Apple TV Plus. And the bidding war for this Sony Pictures movie, which was supposed to come out Father's Day, really heated up. Apple ended up paying, according to Deadline, $70 million for this movie, which was written and produced by Tom Hanks. Wow. I think it's a prestige play as much as a... They're not going to make the money back with subscriptions.
I mean, gets to that problem, right? Of trying to, like, how you're going to watch this. Like, I actually have Apple TV because I have that free subscription
that
I got with my
iPhone. If you buy an Apple device, yeah.
But I don't have any way to watch it on my TV, as far as I know. I don't have the actual... So I've never seen any content. So now... I need to go buy another black box, connect it to my TV to watch this. It's just like...
Do you have a Roku? Because you can... they have an Apple TV app.
I don't.
Do you have a... do you have anything connected to your TV?
I have an Xbox.
I don't think there's an Apple TV app for
Xbox. No, there isn't.
No.
This is like a continuation of what we were talking about. You know, is this the Joe Rogan of Apple TV? And the answer is probably not, because Apple has made the bar really high. Like, it involves hardware.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once you start to involve hardware,
that's a good point.
Then
it's
a different conversation. And this is why I subscribe to every streaming service except that one.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think Disney Plus has done very well, which is good because there's other Disney properties not doing quite so well?
Yeah, Disney Plus did a lot of good deals with carriers. So a lot of people, you know,
Verizon. I'm getting mine from Verizon. That's right. I'm not paying for it.
And Hulu and ESPN too. Yeah. You get discounts.
Hulu, ESPN, Disney Plus bundle was really compelling.
Yep. And they put it everywhere. I can actually watch that on my Xbox because they've released an app. If Apple wants to release an app on Xbox, there's probably a good chance at some point I would, especially because I have technically a free subscription, I'd actually watch the content. So that's where some companies, you know, Disney did a very good job. They, on day one, it was available everywhere. And that's where, but Apple always gets into this, you know, it's cracking a little bit, right? They are putting their app on other things now, including some TV. So it's a start, but they really need to be everywhere.
I am excited about HBO Max, which comes out in a couple of days. Is it
going to be on YouTube TV?
I don't know. Well, that's a good question.
Because they're supposed to have made a deal with HBO, but I've been waiting for HBO to come to
you.
You
can
TV
buy HBO as an extra, can't you, on YouTube TV?
No.
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 You can do it on Amazon Prime.
Right. And Hulu.
And Hulu. Interesting.
But not YouTube.
So your TV comes from YouTube.
It does now. I've used Sling, and I've really liked Sling.
I love YouTube TV. I really do.
They're the best at streaming besides Netflix in terms of quality and optimizing, right?
It's such a hit. You can see why Apple paid $70 million for Greyhound, because it's such a hit-driven business. The only reason people got Disney Plus initially was Mandalorian. Maybe not the only reason. I think Carsten got it.
I think it was the only reason.
Carsten got it for the computer where his tennis shoes. So, but maybe he's the only one. I'm excited about Steve Carell's new show, Space Force, and that's on HBO Max. And for me, that would be worth getting HBO Max. So
I think one of the biggest challenges for HBO Max, quite honestly, is how confusing all the different HBOs are.
It's out.
I don't even know what it is. I'll be honest. I follow this stuff. I don't know what HBO Max actually is. I just kept glossing over it. So
yes, same. I feel that I have read many descriptions, including those on my own publications. And then
Cena has to do an explainer. Like this is what HBO Max is. This is
We have an explainer. We have an explainer that explains all the HBOs next to each other.
Do you have an infographic? What I need is like an infographic with a chart that tells me how much everything is by each month and what shows I can see and what platforms I can see them on. Because if I can have all that comparative information in one quick image, it would make my life so much easier.
I'm still figuring out Go and Now. Like HBO Go and Now, I confuse those all the time. They're both apps. They're in the same place on the store. I'm like, all right, which one do I want? It's like it's a gamble every time.
I have to say, HBO Max, if you can figure out what it is and where it is, and maybe you already have it for free because a lot of people do. I'm also very interested in Seth Rogen's show, just because the name, An American Pickle. He plays a 1920s immigrant and his computer coding great grandson. It's high concept, but it sounds good. I don't know. It's $15 a month, which is what you'd pay if you didn't have HBO at all. It's very confusing.
It's very confusing.
Yeah.
It seems to have different content, and that's really the answer.
It has a huge.
And now you get. As I say, you're getting sub-brands making deals, right?
Yeah.
So on Hulu, they have a sub-brand deal with FX and FXX where they co-broadcast. And sometimes they premiere shows on Hulu first before it even goes to the FX channel. And now on Amazon, you're getting IFC On Demand. I forgot what it's called, like IFC Film or something like that, which is a subscription to Amazon. And it's only on Amazon, apparently. So good luck trying to figure this stuff out. And then there's a Criterion, which I kind of want, but I don't even know how to watch that yet. So who knows?
I'm literally looking at the CNET explainer, which is
I'm also looking at the same thing, and I'm just kind of like,
it's page.
I've
after
read this before, and I have not absorbed it. And he's doing
it. Just break this down.
This
into
is a job he can explaining this.
It's so complicated.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that HBO Max's fault, or is it the world we live in now, or what?
I think that it's the hash. This is actually written by Joan Solzman, who covers streaming media for us. And I think that it has to do with the overlay of the content providers, the people who make the content, like HBO.
Yeah, it's all
and
the deals.
The service providers.
Yes.
And so there's a lot in this article about the overlap of AT&T and HBO and what you're already paying for and whether you're getting this through your cable provider or you're getting it as an add-on. And that just creates this incredibly complicated landscape.
This is now in a nutshell why I'm worried about Spotify owning podcasting, because it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, at least with Spotify, it's technically free. Even Joe Rogan's podcast will be part of the free tier. So that's just a simple app. You download, create an account. But
right. From the user's point of view, it's not a bad thing. It's from the podcaster's point of view that I worry because, you know. And actually, if you're a privacy-focused user, you might not be crazy about it either.
Yeah. The good thing about this stuff is, in theory, you can subscribe and unsubscribe rather quickly.
Right.
But then I feel like, for someone like myself, I need like another service that manages my services. So it tells me where I can just one click and do that. But who's going to make that, right?
Then there's also the issue of who has time to watch all this crap.
Your bank may make that in a weird way. I think that the future, by the way, total jag here, is your bank managing those subscriptions for you. Wells Fargo has started to do some of that.
Oh.
Where you can, like, Wells Fargo will kind of identify recurring stuff and help you
get out of them. That's
great. Yeah.
That's great. I use an app that they've been advertising heavily called Truebill that kind of is supposed to do that, figure out which subscriptions you have and so forth. But, yeah, a bank, that would be a sensible financial service. Be huge.
it's a big value add for a bank to do, because they don't really, they want you to be using your money wisely. They don't have the same incentives to get you to subscribe or unsubscribe from things.
Right.
So they really are a good kind of neutral party to provide that service for you. And I hope that more of them do it.
In our chat room, Dr.
Like, you need a budget to do that.
A budget?
Well, there's an app called You Need a Budget.
Oh, I thought you were telling me something. I do need a budget. Yes.
there's an app called You Need a Budget. People refer to online as YNAB.
And oh, YNAB. I know. I've seen that everywhere. Yeah.
It'd be right in their constituency where they're like, this is your recurring expense. This is how much you're paying every month for Hulu.
Chatroom calls it services as a service.
Yes.
I like it.
This is the level we've reached now. Services is a service.
Yes.
You need services.
Everything is meta.
It's all service. Bad news, if you were hoping to get $125 in your Equifax settlement, so many people applied for it. You might get a few cents. Of course, the banks are going to get money because the Equifax breach forced banks to issue new credit cards in the millions. So banks are going to get $5.5 million. The FTC made Equifax pay a $575 million settlement with, in the words of Ars Technica's Kate Cox, a pinky swear to go forth and sin no more. Individuals supposedly could claim $125 each from the settlement until, that is, the FTC and Equifax remembered that there were 144 million people in the breach. And there wasn't enough cash to pay everybody that much. So as it ends up, you might get a check for 52 cents and a bag of pop chips. I don't know. I mentioned the pop chips because that was the most I've ever gotten a class action lawsuit, was the world famous pop chips. I'm sorry, I mentioned pop chips, and I think I put Lindsay Turrentine into anaphylactic shock. I apologize. I got the settlement in the class action lawsuit was a bag of pop chips. Go ahead. Hydrate while Lindsay is.
I swallowed a piece of mint from my mint tea.
Oh no!
And it went down the wrong way.
I think you're taking mint tea a little too literally, Lindsay.
You know what? I learned this in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. This is how they make mint tea.
But it wasn't mint in the jar. But okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this is actual mint.
That's actually a great idea. Is it good?
It's wonderful.
Do you boil it, or is it sun tea? Or
I boil it. I just pour boiling water over a stick of mint.
Oh, I love it.
Then coffee.
You need a little screen on the top or something. Just a little something to
prevent. Apologies. I'm going to mute myself.
Mint inhalation. Our show today brought to you by Cashfly, and I mean that quite literally. They are our CDN, a content delivery network. And if you notice, you probably don't, that's the beauty of Cashfly, you probably never notice, but when you download shows from our network via our RSS feeds or on our website, they come fast, no buffering, boom, they just come in. That's Cashfly at work. They've been delivering content since 1999. We've been using them almost since the beginning of Twit. I'm a huge fan of Cashfly, partly because they save us money. I mean, they are 30% faster than the competition, and they cost less. They also do some really nice things. They smooth out the cost of your CDN by you know, we're very peaky, as most downloads are, whether it's podcasts or applications or data of any kind. You know, it tends to be peaky. You kind of maybe worry on some CDNs, oh, am I going over my content cap? Not with Cashfly. They average it out over a year, so you know exactly what you're going to pay month after month. And now they have something really cool. This is a little complicated, but if you use a CDN, you'll get it. It's called 100% Cash Shield, and it's going to save you so much money, a drastic reduction in data transfer fees with AWS's S3 and other cloud storage origins, because your cash hit ratio with the CDN will be 100%. Essentially, you're putting your storage not on these third parties, but on Cashfly. Which means when you get a cash hit, when you get your cash items being evicted for large one-off requests costing you a fortune in data transfer out fees, well, it just doesn't happen. With 100% Cash Shield and Cashfly's guaranteed availability, you just avoid that. It's a next-generation content delivery solution for today and tomorrow. You keep your content and data closer to your customers. You don't have to go over the public internet traffic from other companies. You buy as much space as you want. Your data will always be fetched from 100% Cash Shield rather than the origin. Shielding can reduce your origin spend by thousands of dollars a month. And this is no insignificant side benefit, there are no more cache misses. You're going to improve your download speeds. There'll be no more buffering. Guaranteed availability, the highest quality of service. If you're streaming video, it'll scale reliably to reach global audiences of any size. If you're doing gaming, you get hyper-fast download speeds, low latency, and a scalable solution. Your podcast will be delivered quickly and reliably without delays or timeouts, and I can vouch for that. Lightning-fast digital download speeds for large digital files, no matter where your customers are. I love CacheFly. And because they're all over the world, their global throughput performance dominance ensures any cache misses are delivered 5 times faster than from your origins. Just for Twit listeners, CacheFly has given away a complimentary detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends. You may be paying as much as 20% more than you have to. This is no pressure. Just bring them your bill, bring them your usage, and they can tell you if you'll save. Twit.cachefly.com. Twit.cachefly.com. Thank you, CacheFly, for saving me big time. Oh, there's so many stories we haven't got to. Let me see. What about the grandma ordered to delete her Facebook pictures of her grandchildren? This is just a silly story. A GDPR action. Apparently, a mother and daughter were having a fight. Grandma was posting pictures of the grandkids. The daughter said, knock it off. Grandma said, no, they're my grandkids. They went to court, and the judge ruled that the matter was within the scope of the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR. The grandma is ordered to remove the photos or pay a fine of 50 euros a day up to 1,000 euros. And if she posts more images of the grandkids in the future, she'll be fined an extra 50 euros a day.
I love this. I think the kids should get to choose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what happens in a divorce. The kids choose. I want grandma to post the pictures. Maybe they're too little to have a choice.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Every grandma posts.
Yeah, by the time we're in school.
Yeah. Every grandma posts pictures of their grandkids. Would you be unhappy if your mom posted pictures of Facebook of your daughter, Lisa, or?
So I actually did have this conversation with both sets of grandparents.
Oh, okay.
And my reasoning and my thinking was it's my job to be a responsible steward of my daughter's image and her name and whatever her profile online is right
now.
That's
fair. That's fair.
Because she doesn't have the tools to do it.
Yep.
And so because they are part of her circle in the family, they also, my argument to them was they also have that obligation because they're adults.
Yes.
And so I wanted to make sure that if they were going to post pictures, that the people that they accepted as Facebook friends were people they could vouch for in real life, that they were people they felt comfortable exposing this information to, and that they would also understand if my daughter or I at any future point reserve the right to ask them to take it down. And it was a little bit of a weird conversation to have because one parent, one grandparent was like, how is this any different than throwing student pictures in an envelope and sending them out with a Christmas card?
But the Christmas card goes to one person, Facebook goes to everybody.
And digital assets can be replicated and reused and downloaded ways that, like, you lose control in a way that you don't with a physical object. And so we did have to work through the idea that we'd like to think that everybody that we know digitally online is a good actor. That's not always the case. Please be responsible about assessing and evaluating. And then once my daughter hit elementary school, we started passing everything by her. Like, if I mention her on Twitter, I make sure that I talk to her about it first and she's okay with what we tweet. Sometimes she's like, you can tweet what I just said. And we do the same thing with pictures, and it's an ongoing discussion with, you know, this is your, you're gonna have a public data trail, and as your parents, it's our job to start you off strong.
No, that's fair.
And hopefully give you the skills to build it up over time on your own and take it over by the time you're in your teens.
Good news for Section 230 fans. This is the Communication Decency Act section that says that social networks are not responsible. They're not they're common carriers, in effect. They're not publishers of the content. There was a lawsuit against Facebook from back in 2016 because Facebook hosted accounts, at least the lawsuit claimed, knowingly belonging to Hamas, which is, of course, classified as a terrorist organization. Under Section 230, that, you know, you can't sue a website for that. But the lawsuit said Facebook's algorithm, there's the algorithm again, promoted terrorist content to people who liked similar pages or posts. And as a result, they should be more liable. Their immunity should be reduced or eliminated. They lost in court. This lost in court. Facebook won. Second Circuit Court shot down the complaint, saying there's no basis for making Facebook liable because it arranged content with algorithms. It was appealed to the Supreme Court, and this week the Supreme Court rejected the case, letting the ruling stand. So a victory for Section 230, I guess. You agree?
This is always that tough case scenario, right? It's, yeah. I mean, it comes down to freedom of speech. Not in this exact case, but those are the examples used. It's never the things you want to hear that we all agree upon. It's always the tough ones. Cases.
Yeah.
The ones that are like, is this what we really want? Because no one is going to publicly, oh, yeah, we should let terrorist groups and let them use these platforms for this stuff. But at the same time, yeah, you can't have these companies being completely responsible. What needs to be done is put pressure on these companies to figure out how they can solve these problems with their algorithms and everything.
Lindsay, do you think that Facebook's more liable because their algorithm might have promoted the Hamas posts?
Yes. And I think that the problem here is that when we talk about free speech, we're often talking about the ability to share your opinion, even if it's controversial or negative. And then the responsibility of a private company when it comes to that. To what degree is Facebook, a utility versus just a service that makes makes money through passing along information? I think that an algorithm promoting something is in a way effectively an endorsement of that.
Interesting.
Not necessarily an endorsement of the content itself, yes, but an endorsement of the power of the content.
And it gives it power.
And amplifying something.
It amplifies it. Yeah.
Right. It's saying more people should hear this. We have decided that more people should hear this. And we, in this case, is the algorithm. And that's where it gets really, really tricky. But I tend to fall on the side of caution here, right? Like, go ahead and put your stuff there. But if it is dangerous, and that's where it gets really hazy, don't spread it. It's really tough. I mean, we were talking about this at home the other day, and I kind of think that the laws in this country around free speech and what that means and how it was interpreted came before the ability for machines to amplify a thought.
Right. It's the same
we
problem.
Had printing presses, but you had to have the resources to do that, and maybe we need to take another look at it.
Well, very famously, mere months after the First Amendment was passed, the federal government passed the Sedition Act, which was completely against freedom of speech. It permitted the deportation, fine, or imprisonment of anyone publishing false, scandalous, or even malicious writing in the United States against the government. Wow. So that was in 1798. So we have a long and checkered history about the First Amendment. In this case, it's not the government restricting I guess it would be the government restricting what Facebook could do, but it is Facebook's right to publish or not publish stuff. I think the algorithm argument's very interesting. I mean, we have the same problem with YouTube promoting extremist content algorithmically. I don't think that the YouTube employees or staff or Google wants to do that, but the algorithm does. At what point don't they become responsible for what the algorithm's doing?
Yeah, and how is the algorithm, know, humans have, you know, there was sort of, you know, there's the old pornography, you know it when you see it issue. And if you rely on humans and you know it when you see it to make educated decisions about what is appropriate to share and what isn't, and then you, that's one thing. Turning those decisions over to an algorithm is fully another thing, because that algorithm is probably always going to move to our most base instincts, not our most educated instincts.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why they work.
Exactly.
Finally, I mean, I don't mean finally like this finally happened. I mean, our final story, Walmart is discontinuing Jet.com. It bought it for $3 billion. It was an attempt to go after Amazon. It had an interesting algorithmic base. The pricing was based on, you know, the situation, I guess, and how much you bought, et cetera, et cetera. Walmart needed to get an online, you know, to online sales to compete with Amazon. They bought Jet. 4 years later, they're discontinuing it. Visits to the site have plummeted. The brand is not taking off. That's a pretty big loss for Walmart. Although, I got to point out, Walmart's doing all right in e-commerce. 74% surge in online sales.
That's what's so weird about this.
Yeah.
They built this whole thing and are not using it.
They've had a really checkered approach to e-commerce, too, because they bought ModCloth, and that hasn't worked out for them. There was some men's clothing site that they also bought that I think they recently gutted. It seems like they really don't know how to build an audience online and capitalize on their logistical and in-store network either. It's kind of baffling.
I think the story of Jet is interesting because the guy who founded it, Mark Lohr, founded it because he hated Amazon. He had started diapers.com and soap.com in 2005, and Amazon essentially took it down in a price war. They've done this before with other online stores by just undercutting them. And eventually he was forced to sell to Amazon. Amazon acquired both brands for $545 million. The company, the parent company, is Quidsi. He left Quidsi in 2013 and then started Jet.com 3 years later to try once again to beat the Amazon juggernaut. He started it at 2013. 3 years later, he sold it to Walmart for $3.3 billion. And now here we are 7 years later. And Amazon has won money again.
He spent a lot of money hating on Amazon.
He hates Amazon.
I wish I had this problem in my life.
Hates Amazon.
I hate a company or something so badly that I've made
$545 million and then $3.3 billion. Not bad, right? Not bad.
No.
He is still Walmart's CEO of e-commerce. So I guess he still has a job. Although why he's working, I have no idea. Hey, if I got $100 million, I'd retire.
Huh? He hates Amazon.
He hates him.
Why?
Hey, I'm going to kill Amazon. I'm going to kill him. Oh, this has been so much fun. Thank you, Lindsay Turrentine, for deigning to hang out with us lowly people.
This is my favorite. This is so fun.
You're great. Senior Vice President, Content Strategy, Viacom CBS. I swear to God, you're going to be running Viacom CBS soon. So just
I would not worry about that happening.
You don't see that not in the cards.
I mean, you never know, right? But I'm pretty much focused on the tech brands and the CNET Media Group.
Nice, and doing it in a hell of a good job.
By the way, we're launching a whole package next week on CNET about CNET's 25th birthday.
Ooh, I can't wait to see that.
I can't, too. Yeah. You know, I was CNET's fourth employee. I wonder if they'll mention me.
Well, I'm writing the intro tonight.
So I've told you this story, right? Halsey Miner and Shelby Bonney. Have I told you this story?
I haven't heard it.
I was doing a radio show in 1992. I was doing a syndicated computer talk show with Dvorak. And I got a call from this guy, Halsey Miner, who was a hedge fund, you know, boy wonder, saying, hey, we want to start a television network about computers. You seem to be the only one doing a national computer talk show. Mm-hmm. You should come to work for us. I said, okay. He made me, I think I was a VP of marketing. There was only four of us. It was him, Shelby Bonney, another hedge fund guy, and financier. And I think there was one other person working there. The first job he gave me was, well, how much is it going to cost for us to start a 24-hour tech network? This is 1992. And I came back saying, I'll give you an example. CNN took them $50 million a year for 10 years before they made any money. That's $500 million. How much do you have, Halsey? And at that point, and I take some credit for this, they pivoted to the website strategy with a little TV on the side. He also fired me, but that was another story for another day.
I want to hear that story. This is the 25th anniversary of the website.
Yeah. 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 So 92. So that 25th anniversary would have been 95.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this was early on. He really, and we even did a pilot. John C. Dvorak and I did a very much like this show, a roundtable show pilot. And that's, I think, what got me fired. And the weird thing about, did you ever meet Halsey Miner?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Quite a character. The weird thing about Halsey, he never told me I didn't work for him. He just went radio silent. This was shortly after, and I kicked myself. He said, you know, we need some, if you could put $10,000 into this, I'd give you, I don't know, 20%. And I said, I just bought a house, Halsey. I don't have any cash. Mm-hmm. Anyway, little did I know. What did I know? I'm an idiot. So 6 months later, he says, come on and visit. This is when he was in the railroad car down on the waterfront.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that office.
Remember that? Yeah, he was in a railroad car. He said, come on down. I'd like to show you my railroad car. And he said, you know, Ziff Davis is looking for a TV guy. You should go call them. And a hint I took and did call them. In fact, they hired me, Bill McCrone and Gary. I can't remember his name. They hired me. So that went well. But that was a weird interregnum. I don't even know if they paid me. I can't even remember if I... The real reason Halsey didn't like me is he wanted to go down to SIGGRAPH, and he said, would you get airplane tickets? We'll go down to SIGGRAPH. We'll see what's going on. This was a big graphics conference. And I made the mistake of, instead of buying a nice jet airplane tickets, I got us a turbojet to L.A. because it was cheap and quick. And he didn't like that. So I think that was the end of my career. So,
that was it?
Yeah.
That was your last decision?
That was my last decision as an executive of CNET. Number three or number four employee? Do not put me in that story. But you should know. You should know. I have something to do with CNET success. I left. Thank you. It's great to have you, Lindsay. Lisa Schmeiser, you can catch her work at IT Pro Today at itprotoday.com. We should probably give out the website. Yes. And L. Schmeiser on the Twitter. Thank you so much. Please thank your husband for letting us use his Chicago Cubs memorabilia room for your studio today.
Yes.
We appreciate it. And Daniel Rubino, always a pleasure, executive editor at Windows Central, where you do such great work, and your coverage of the Microsoft Build conference was fantastic. I really appreciate all of that. And I thank you for being here. Yeah. Go play Minecraft Dungeons. I'm so jealous.
Yes.
I won't be around on Tuesday. I'll be playing that game. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon right after the radio show, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern. That's 21:30 UTC. You can watch us do it live or listen live on the stream. That's twit.tv/live. Or you could ask your Amazon Echo or your Google Companion or whatever to play the Twit live stream. And sometimes it does, which is kind of cool. If you're listening live, you should go into the chat room. They're doing it too, irc.twit.tv. If you're listening offline after the fact, we also have a community for you, twit.community, our forum. It's really great. A lot of fun in there. Some fabulous people. twit.community. You can get on-demand versions of our show at the website, twit.tv. You can also get them on YouTube or, again, ask your Amazon Echo to play This Week in Tech podcast, and it'll play the latest version. Best thing to do is subscribe. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app. It could be Spotify, but it could be Stitcher or Slacker or Pocket Cast or Overcast or the Google Podcast app or the Apple Podcast app. It doesn't matter. If you subscribe, you'll get it at the minute it's available every week. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
this is amazing.
Bye-bye.